Welcome to the Great Base Tennis Podcast. I'm Andy Fitzell, your co-host, alongside Steve Smith. Welcome to episode number 14.
14.
And tonight we're talking about a lost art.
The volley. Someone comes up to you, you're at a park, you're hitting against the backboard, and they want to ask you to hit, and you go, you want to volley some?
Yeah, exactly.
You know they don't know. You want to rally when the ball bounces. But a volley, to define it, it's a ball that's hit in the air.
Yeah.
But no, for sure, it's a lost art. Why don't you talk a little bit about the momentum source of power for the volley?
Yeah, so one thing we talk about, especially when people talk about power, is that volleys use a momentum source of power. So you get roughly about half the incoming speed of the ball. So if somebody hits 80 miles per hour, you're pretty much going to get about 50% of that just by blocking the ball. But so you get half of your opponent's speed, and then you get about 1.5 times your own racket speed, which isn't a ton on the volley unless you have a huge swing. And then the other source of power is the body moving forward. So those
speed of the incoming ball and speed of the body going forward.
Yeah.
When people are warming up, it's traditional. But when you're warming up, you're just warming up. You're in a stationary position.
Right.
A lot of positives to players doing two-on-ones where you have two players at the net, one at the baseline.
Mm-hmm.
But a negative is the players at the net are standing there and they're not going forward.
Yeah. That's so misleading too, I think, for a lot of the listeners, junior tennis players, especially when they watch the pros warm up. You know, it's just casual, and they're playing a lot of backhand volleys, especially because the other person is hitting right to them. You know, so there's a lot of body shots, and they're just kind of standing in one place. There's not a whole lot of closing in and finishing or really trying to hit the ball deep and stick it. And that can be misleading.
Yeah, the most watched player ever now, Roger Federer.
Yeah.
I love to watch Roger Federer play a match on how much fun he has hitting the ball to the ball kids.
Yeah.
He just wants, the ball's coming to him. He knows right where the ball kid's going to be. Yeah. He just tries to put it right in their hands, and he's having fun with it. He's so relaxed when he plays. But when you watch him warm up, it's not how he plays. Also, too, when you're at, Indian Wells or the U.S. Open, wherever, and you're watching the top players go have a light hit, it's not like you're watching them train.
Yeah. Now, I've been lucky enough to be, as you know, on the court with Roger a couple times, and he's always just working on his motor skills. You know, he's playing around with the forearm working on his hands. And, but he also said, I'm a difficult person to copy. So it's not that you don't want to try to copy some of the fundamentals of the pros, but just be careful because it can be deceiving.
Yeah. As we talked about with our podcast, they're interconnected. So one of our guests, Matt Clore, previous guest, I was with him at the US Open and he's coaching Mackenzie McDonald. So he's going to a practice session.
Right.
And I'm not part of that practice session, but I went to it. So there were like 5,000 people watching.
Yeah.
Ball goes over Federer's head, backhand side.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the shot that they put on the cereal box Wheaties.
Yeah.
It's such a short hitting zone, the high backhand. And he hits a drop shot, angled drop shot. And he kind of looks around like, did anybody see that?
Did you guys see that?
I'm not sure how many people were there could really appreciate it, but I think he surprised himself a little bit with that one.
He's like, that just happened.
But so many types of volleys. A generation before, a lot of the times, the pillars that we talk about with our great base curriculum, Vic Bray and Dennis Vandermeer, Bill Jacobson. A generation before was Bill and Chet Murphy. And they both wrote a number of books. But I remember with Chet, and this is true, there's a touch volley, there's a drop volley, angled volley, snap volley, reflex volley, drag volley, cut volley.
Yeah.
You know, we could be out there telling a kid, no excessive hand motion. Don't cup the ball.
Yeah.
In that situation, I mean, stage development, you really want to be able to teach someone to hit a basic volley.
Yeah.
Rick Macy's obviously had a great deal of success with coaching tennis. He's a background similar to really to Bollettieri, a motivator.
Mm-hmm.
And, he's taken a lot of kids from one stage to another. But I remember Rick saying with the two-handed backhand volley, the governing body of American tennis used to issue a rule that kids should not be able to hit a two-handed backhand volley.
That's when Patrick McEnroe was heading the show there, right? I mean, he has a two-handed backhand
volley. Yeah, Patrick has a two-handed backhand volley. But I was going to a little higher level than Patrick with Pete Sampras. I mean, Patrick, when he's a freshman, he played six at Stanford. To me, that's a high level. And, then he got to the semis of the Australian Open. So just teasing in one hand. But with Sampras, we show that film over and over again, hitting a two-handed backhand volley. We have a better chance of developing a two-handed backhand volley than a one-handed backhand volley.
Yeah, I don't because know why that doesn't make sense to people. Yeah.
Because you can stabilize the racket. It's you know, we film kids. They come in. And I mean, from California, we just had a young sixth grader here today. And he has a two-handed backhand. So he's got a two-handed backhand return. But he has a one-handed backhand volley. I say, well, let's work on a two-handed backhand volley. It's just money. You know, right away, they're going to look at the sidelines. If mom is with them, they're looking right at mom. Mom, what? Doesn't he know? Doesn't he know who I am? I have a one-handed backhand volley.
Yeah.
With, let's talk a little bit about grips.
Uh-oh.
Grips on the volley. We are in the vast minority on the forehand side. Why don't you tell our listeners why?
Well, because we're not going to teach a true continental grip, even to an advanced player. And really, I mean, I've looked at so many pictures even just recently where you see players, you'll see a backhand volley where they're almost on an Eastern forehand grip. Because on their forehand grip, it's almost an Eastern, you know, so they can square up the racket, hit it flat or stick the volley. And then, if they're not trained to switch grips to a backhand, they're going to switch their wrist. You know, I was looking at a video. I'll post it one of these days here of Jamie Murray, the doubles player. And he's doing a low backhand volley. And you see, you know, the racket face is open because he's on a composite grip between continental and a forehand, Eastern forehand. And he's coming in and you just see before impact, his wrist pushes out to make the racket square. It's a low volley. It's about 10 degrees open. And then he sticks it. And, so we're in the vast minority that we're not going to teach a true continental grip to any really level player, even a high level player, but especially for beginning players, developmental players, you want to use the palm as a guide. And that's where the Eastern grip is going to line up your hand with the strings.
With a continental grip, obviously we had an episode on tennis math. For the serve and overhead, you want to use a continental grip. Emergency shot when the ball is behind you, you want to use a continental grip. When it comes down to the math, if you turn the racket 8 times, it goes in full circle, 360 degrees. So you divide 360 by the number of bevels, 8, and you get 45.
Yep.
Jack Kramer, this is in the beginning of Vic Braden's book. Jack Kramer could buy a golf course, build a tennis club, because he knew under pressure that Gonzalez was going to go cross court on the forehand volley.
Yeah.
With, I think Jose Aguirre says it very well, it's almost a continental grip. It's the top players will volley with a composite grip.
Yeah.
You know, say the Bryan brothers, and I know you've been on the court with them.
Yeah.
And I've seen film that you and Vic had with the Bryan brothers.
Yeah, just quickly even go back to Gonzalez. The reason why he knew that is because when he got him on the stretch with a true continental grip, it's almost impossible to hit without a lot of wrist contortion down the line for his volley. So he knew he could most of the time just run cross court.
But with a continental grip, it's like some of our listeners are very young, but Johnny Mack, McEnroe, because he had a continental grip, he couldn't go way out in front. So he would jump.
Yeah.
He was so good.
Yeah.
You know, and certainly you can contort the wrist, you can raise the elbow more.
Yeah, which he did too. He raised the elbow.
Yeah, so it's not against the rules.
Yeah.
But it sounds so simple. I know that I can remember reading a book written by Bud Collins, late Bud Collins, with Laver, Tennis Digest. And it just made so much sense. Just use one grip. You don't have to change.
Yeah.
And easily 9 out of 10 people are going to tell you volley with a continental grip because coaches are creatures of habit and they teach the way they were taught.
Yeah.
And research and practice are greatly removed in tennis. There's a disconnect.
Yeah. The time that I was on the court with Mike and Bob, I mean, I grew up with them in the juniors. They were a couple years younger than me. But with Vic, we were able to just film them all day, really just to make sure we could get some volleys because we had a 10-year project at the Indian Wells tournament there where we filmed on stadium court, but we couldn't set the cameras up to point right at the net. And then also people just don't go to the net. Even, you know, the pros are not going to the net very often. So they agreed to let us come out and just film them so we could capture more volleys. And I asked Bob, I said, show me your grip on your volley, or what grip do you use? And he just put out his hand and he goes, this one. You know, he just said this. And you could see that his knuckle was, you know, not quite on top Eastern, but it was in between the continental. So they may say, oh, continental grip, but it's not quite a continental grip.
We have a young guest here who plays the saxophone. Mm-hmm. And if you want to be inspired, go to a concert. If you want to be instructed, go to a teacher. But when it comes down to the very top players, they don't say what they do or do what they say. Someone's at a jazz concert and there's a fantastic player on the saxophone. They're not going to articulate. They're not going to intellectualize how they hit that note.
Yeah.
But also, too, stage development is starting a kid to change their grips. The late Dennis Vandermeer, he was so persuasive. What takes more time, to change your grip or not change your grip?
Yeah.
And really, it takes the same amount of time. You just have to be trained.
Yeah.
But at a high level, when you go up to hit an overhead, it's a lob, so you have a little more time. So especially if you're using your left hand properly, if you're a right-hander, you have more time to get to the continental.
Yeah.
From the service line in, every time you split step, if you put your racket in almost the continental, it's a composite, you're ready for the forehand volley.
Yeah.
So to change for the backhand, it's like a chest pass. Braden used to say that, just push both palms out. Not only have to change your grip for backhand volley, you have to change the position of your arm. Granted, you got to turn your body, you got to make adjustments with your feet.
Yeah.
So John Wooden, the fundamental doesn't change, the speed at which you have to execute the fundamental. So when people watch us teaching tennis very, very slowly, I remember a woman from South Africa bringing her daughter to work with us for several years, it was 20 years ago, and she said, you are not microwave tennis. No, so we don't go where it's just super, super fast.
Before I even talk about grips with coaches especially, I just say, well, let's just talk about the path of the racket. Because if you can kind of agree upon that, you know, and there are coaches out there really that like to teach spin, you know, to take off speed and have underspin on their volleys. But so if you can agree upon the path of the racket, okay, the path of the racket to the path of the target. So then it's like, okay, if you want to swing on a tabletop, right, flatter to the target, have a long hitting zone, if you can establish that fact, then it's easy with a grip, because you just go, well, the continental grip on the forehand side, you know, it's going to open the racket face 45 degrees up and to the left if you're right-handed. So then either you have to adjust your wrist or you have to adjust your grip. So it's, for me, it's always, hey, let's talk about the path of the racket. How do you want the path of the racket to go to the target?
Yeah.
Or do you want it to go down?
Now, I remember watching Doug McCurdy teach tennis years ago, and that was a way that he would approach teaching tennis. You know, many times we're teaching too much control. You know, Peter Berwash has all these creative drills, which are very good. You know, hitting the ball twice, you're up at the net, you know, stop it on your forehand volley, hit a backhand volley.
Yeah.
And you have to be able to maneuver the racket like that. So when you think of people play like the Bryan brothers, it comes back to Chet Murphy.
Yeah,
there is going to be a time where you have to improvise and, you know, drag the racket back in and play a volley.
Yeah, you got to do it all at that level.
But feel versus fact, too, is that, you know, I've talked to so many teaching pros over the years, and they feel like they never miss a volley. But I go, well, you know, you're hitting with Sally from the ladies' team, and you're hitting with little Johnny in the Tennis for Tykes class.
Yeah.
And when you're up at the net volleying, you know, the teaching pro-itis with a continental grip. But when you're swinging fast or the ball's coming in fast or a combination of both. But I think the feel versus fact. When people hit a volley, okay, so the ball is dipping with topspin,
right?
And they bring their racket, you know, down to a low ball. Mm-hmm. They don't hit the geometric center of the racket,
right?
So then the racket displacement, the moving racket after the hit, is many times what happens is they hit above the geometric center, so the underside turns up.
Yeah,
and you hear people teach by that by feel all the time. You need to lead in with the bottom edge.
Yeah.
Well, we know from science, the research and practice. Not if you're hitting a touch, angled volley, but if you're driving a volley deep off a low ball, like you said, the racket face is open less than 10 degrees.
Yeah.
A continental grip opens the racket face at 45.
Yeah.
But I like how you said it's a lost art. when it comes down to why don't people go to the net, we can touch upon that. Why don't you talk a little bit about brain memory?
Yeah, well, the term muscle memory is often used. I think probably the most understood when it comes to a motor program, right? But really, muscles don't store memory. It's the brain. So we use that term brain memory. And that's where, you know, it's an electrical signal coming from the brain to the muscles.
I like the term brain memory to try to motivate a young kid. Hey, you're a biocomputer, and we got to rewrite the software package.
Yeah.
And you're programmed, you know, good myelin, bad myelin, and explain that to them.
Yeah.
One thing with brain memory, you know, people don't go to the net because they don't go to the net. They're not programmed to go to the net.
Exactly.
And they need to go from the beginning, from the get-go. Why don't they go to the net, though? Other reasons. A young player will go to the net to lose at a faster rate.
Yeah.
You know, you just know that a young kid doesn't really, they're not really comfortable, confident to close in because they can be lobbed so easily.
Yeah.
But then it also, if they're volleying with a continental grip, so you have some young 10-year-old, he's got a continental grip. He's not strong enough to volley with that grip. The racket face is open. Angle the racket face up. Angle the racket path down.
Yep.
Plus they have to go slower.
Yep.
Balls hit three ways. Plus is strong, minus is weak, IP's in play. So they hit a soft, and they hit a minus volley.
Yeah.
So then they're easy to lob. And it's like, well, I went up there, Vic Braden, I went up there in April last year, and I haven't been back since.
Yeah.
I only go to pick up the paycheck.
I was going to say, for me, I want to touch one thing on, you said before, you know, with not hitting the ball in the geometric center. You know, today's rackets, and I know we're going to talk about wooden rackets, but today's rackets are a bit more forgiving. If you do hit off center, you can still maintain some power in your shot. But also, especially on the backhand volley, the force of the impact will push the racket down. And we have a video up of Ken Rosewall, I believe it is, who, you know, he had a severe layback, and then he swings on an arc to get a little extra racket speed. The racket's vertical at the hit, but then after the hit, from the force of the impact, you see the racket go backwards a little bit and down. But when you see that in real time, it just looks like they're chopping down on the ball. And yet when they measure the revolutions, it's almost totally flat. So that's just wanted to go back to that point. You don't see it as much on the forehand volley, but you definitely see it on the backhand volley. In the pro game, definitely they're cutting some backhand volleys for sure because their grip is composite. So they have this open racket face. And like you just said, open racket face, the path has to go down. But you also don't see those guys going to the net very often. I mean, really, there's, you know, you watch the guys warm up and that's pretty much all you're going to see in volley.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes there is no, they don't even warm up at the net.
Yeah, it's just like, okay.
Even though they say at the futures level.
Yeah.
One thing about youth versus veteran matches. In this country, we have the NTRP. Been a great model for social tennis.
Yeah.
But we don't really have the veteran player playing with the youngster so much anymore. Now, just think back years ago, people were taught one grip. Maybe about 5 years ago, 2 years back to back, I took a couple of players as a coach, which was a lot of fun, to the 70 and overs. And there weren't too many two-handed backhands because back when they were kids, nobody was playing a two-handed backhand. So, but a lot of continental forehands and backhands.
Yeah.
So they were better with hitting a drop shot because of the continental grip.
Yeah.
So when a young player plays a senior player, as I said in one of these podcasts, the mushroom, they got the big hat, they got the pout belly, they got the band on their elbow, and they just bring the kid in and they throw the lob up.
Yeah.
And, you know, the kid's got matching shoes, headband, racket, bag, it all matches. And they're yelling and screaming because they're losing to the 60-year-old who's 20 pounds, 30 pounds overweight.
Yep.
It makes me think of a match between two guys from St. Louis, Bobby McKinley and Jimmy Connors. And Gloria Connors was there. Bobby won. You know, just lived on the other side of the river, but Bobby just brought him to the net and lobbed, And Gloria went up to him afterwards. It's a famous tennis story. She just took her fingers, pointed at young Bobby McKinley's face. You will never beat him that way again. And they went home and they practiced, bringing him in.
One thing I was thinking of too, I'm jumping around here a little bit with ADD, but fear. You know, people don't come to the net too. They're afraid, you know, of getting hit. Like I just think of, I think of my wife, you know, it's like, you know, she can technically volley, okay, you know, but it's like, oh, as the speed of the game goes up, people are afraid of getting hit.
Well, you can see in mixed doubles, mixed troubles. Now, I know you wouldn't do that, but the macho male ego, they tell their girlfriend, well, you can stand here, but then as you know, then the girlfriend becomes the wife. They go, you need to hide in the alley. Then after a few years of marriage, why don't you just go sit on the bench and I'll cover the whole court.
Cover the all important.
People are, they're playing doubles. They're just hoping it doesn't come to me.
Yeah.
You know, a kid's playing one up, one back. I mean, it's like, I don't want to go up and dump the volley. I'll just stay back and bang ground strokes.
I think the cure, I mean, of people being afraid to go to the net, not only just to lose the point, but literally being hit, is just to improve. You know, you got to improve your skills. And I was reading something recently where it's a good drill where just go out there without a racket. And someone could start at, you know, the service line. You could do mini tennis. You can just try to reach out and catch the ball. Then they go to the baseline and they can hit and you just catch the ball. So you kind of eliminate that fear factor with the racket and just see if you can work on your reaction time of just catching a ball. I think that's a good drill for that.
Yeah. Shepard Mead wrote a book, How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. And it was very, very popular.
Yeah.
So then he wrote a book, he loved tennis, How to Succeed in Tennis Without Really Trying.
Yeah.
So you take the role of the stretcher and the role of the spoiler. You know, the junior, a lot of times, they're just going to try to play TV tennis or just trying to bang the ball. Mm. But the spoiler will, okay, you don't like the net, so I'll bring you to the net.
Yeah.
But typically what happens with young kids, I see, you know, things very quickly with Hugo Gaston. I was fortunate to just let him join our small group a few years ago, travel around under 14s. You know, I was in 4 months in 10 different countries, but he hooked up with us and you know, he was 12 and everybody else was 14. Mm. I kept telling the guys, this guy is really good.
Mm-hmm.
And because he was just so cool,
mm-hmm.
but he would bring kids in. And granted, he was a master of hitting topspin lob way back then, but he'd bring kids in and he'd just bang the ball right at them. And then they would miss and they'd start screaming. And then he was cool and they were not cool.
Yeah.
Hanging around a tennis facility, I don't think that happens so much anymore. And I think a lot of it, unfortunately, you know, kids don't just get on their bike and ride to the park or ride to the club.
Yeah.
You know, they play from 9 to 11. Their parents bring them at 9 and take them at 11. But kids used to just hang around, and sometimes the seniors would be missing a player mm-hmm. and say, hey, kid, come and join us.
Yeah.
And it's like, come up to the net.
Oh, I remember when I first started playing, I was playing with the older ladies, you know. This old lady from, I think she was from Japan or something. Her name was Miyoko. It was like, she always gave us this weird salt candy after we were done or whatever. But it was like battling with Miyoko today.
All those stories. You know, I started playing tennis late, and I think that really helped me out from a teaching, coaching standpoint. I didn't learn tennis through osmosis. So I became big buddies with Wayne Sabin. Wayne was top 10 in the world. He won the Wimbledon plate. They used to have consolation in Wimbledon.
Yeah.
So I was playing doubles with him. Ball bounces. I'm right at the net. And at least I hit it up the middle, but I let the ball bounce, hit it up the middle. And he swore like a sailor. I had just met him, too. He just came over, and he just, you know, reminded me of my days in the hockey locker room. Now, how stupid, like a new kind of stupid. How stupid are you?
They swear in hockey?
A little bit. to come up to the net.
Hanging out at clubs. It doesn't happen too much anymore, unfortunately.
Yeah. You know, I think also, too, one thing that happens is in tennis teaching, too many times, the customer's always right. The only business is the repeat business.
Yeah.
You like staying back? You can stay back. That's your style.
Oh, yeah.
You don't have to come to the net. You know, I talked to a player that we spent years with now, and, you know, he's got to be where he's a blue chip. I keep reminding him, you played at least 3 or 4 years of tournament tennis where you never went to the net.
Yeah.
So ideas, information, insights equal instincts.
Yeah.
If you don't go, you don't go. I mean, a 12-year-old kid, they should be thinking, I'm up 40 love. All right, no one will even notice. I made a serve right to the middle, so it's going to come back to the middle, and I'm going to serve and volley.
Yeah.
But can you imagine playing a year of tournament tennis, singles and doubles, and not serve and volley?
Yeah.
Someone was asking about Noah and Ruben's podcast the other day, and I said, you know, I spent a day, a young kid we worked with, did well in juniors for sure. I'm sure he will continue to. He spent 5 years with us, and so did his sister, really helping him out. Mm-hmm. So Radina Lillo's older sister of Victor, Radina and I spent a day with watching Noah Ruben. He's a junior Wimbledon champion. He's coming to play.
Yeah.
One of the players we're working with. And so fast. So we watched him play singles and doubles. He served and volleyed one time.
Yeah.
And that was in a singles match.
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, to be a serve and volley, you need two things. You need to serve and volley. And if you don't serve and volley, you don't serve and volley.
Yeah. I mean, the whole reason is, hey, you don't have to, but what happens when you play the player that has better ground strokes than you? Know?
Richard Hernandez mentioned in a previous podcast, lack of confrontation.
Yeah.
It's like, it's like people are very sensitive about what they eat. So you're saying, hey, don't eat that. It's like, well, don't do this, don't do that. And so anyway, when it comes down to breaking the comfort zone and forcing people to go in with, I know we have drills written down. We'll go through that, but
yeah,
one bounce doubles and one bounce singles.
Yeah.
A lack of charting. It's a junior tennis match. And I know we spend more time in the mechanics for sure, but but if you're going to be a betting person, say, hey, let's have a little wager. We're chart the match. There's 50 points played in a set. Two sets. It's going to be about 100 points played. Mm-hmm. It could be less than five volleys hit.
Yeah.
They're junior tennis, it may not be one overhead.
Yeah.
If you're playing tennis really well, aggressive percentage tennis, you're going to hit a lot over,
yeah,
a lot of overheads.
Yeah.
When you go to the net, you hit a volley, which is basically just a pushing motion. The forehand side, we says, it's like catching a ball.
Yeah.
Is you give yourself more court and you give them less court.
Yeah.
The other thing too is that, why don't people volley is they don't understand the geometry of the court. They don't value 3 feet from that 130 degrees. Then yeah, they don't trust their volley or overhead.
Right.
But if with stats, if you go to the net and you win 2 out of 3, that's a D in school, 66%. Yeah. But in tennis, it's an A+.
Exactly.
And you think about people like, say, an Ed Burke. I just love to quote the pros. Because Federer started going to the net more when he's working with Ed Burke.
Yeah.
And they said, why don't you go even more? And Federer said, I would if I volleyed like he did.
Exactly.
Or Vic asked Agassi one time.
Yeah.
I remember Agassi playing Nadal and really hitting through Nadal, 36 years old, Canadian Open hardcore.
Yeah.
And Vic said, why don't you go to the net more? We have this on tape. And Agassi goes, have you ever seen me volley?
Yeah.
Exactly. Why don't you start with the history with the wooden rackets, the 3 out of 4 grand slams on bad grass?
You're the one to talk to about that, man. Come on.
Well, we have wooden rackets. We have eight of them.
I didn't play in that era with wooden rackets.
We have 8 wooden rackets.
You did a little bit, right? You played.
How
much did you play with the wood?
With
rackets.
Well, I could tell you. Welby Van Horn in 1939 was in the U.S. Open final, and he used a Dunlop Max Ply. 1979. McEnroe, U.S. Open final. He's using the same racket.
Yeah.
McEnroe, he did switch to Wilson at one point. But, if you think 1939, 1979, the rackets didn't improve that much.
I think of like Arthur Ashe, the
head racket.
The head racket, It's kind of like, whoa.
First, Billie Jean King used it for a while, but Jimmy Connors is the one who, the T2000 was the first.
Yeah.
That wasn't a wooden racket. Years ago, the players would have, like, say, a Newcomb, and maybe it was in Australia where he's using a Slazenger, and he'd come to the United States, and he'd be using a Rawlings. Mm. And they use a different racket from one continent to the next because the marketing wasn't global.
Yeah.
And, sometimes players, like a Laver, was using a Dunlop Max Ply for a long time. And then he went to Kemhold, but what he did is he took his wooden racket and spray-painted it gold.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, I don't like that new racket. I got to win this match. I'm going my old racket.
No, but I mean, 3 of the 4 grand slams, on grass, it's going to get a lot of people to use composite grips and get to the net.
Well, also too, the second week of Wimbledon, US Open, people say the grass is worse at Forest Hills. But but the players would be wearing spikes. Now when it rains, there's so much money. At Wimbledon, for example, where they still play on grass, it starts to rain, and that court is covered with a tarp right away. And because but second week, they're wearing spikes, so they couldn't let the ball bounce. Also, too, playing, you know, years ago, like, say, if you go to the Queen's Club in London, you know, playing on wood. Say, you know, that's another surface where you don't want the ball to bounce. But with a wooden racket, kids should train all the time with a wooden racket. You know, say they play a tournament, they come back on Monday, and say, why don't you have an easy hit? And, you know, you feel like you're hitting with a broom. I mean.
Yeah, I mean, if you hit it off center, you're going to feel it, and you're going to lose power, too. So as far as just having clean strokes, you know, obviously with the volley, but with even everything else.
No, I tell parents, anytime you see a garage sale, stop, see if you find some wooden rackets. They're hard to find.
We have a nice little collection.
Well, the pandemic, you know, we don't have as many visitors now, but usually we have visitors on a regular basis. Coaches will bring me wooden rackets when they come. When you think about money's taken away from the volley. Like a Jimmy Connors, you know, I mean, he was born in 1952, so, you know, he's no spring chicken anymore. But with Jimmy, he won Wimbledon and the U.S. Open playing doubles. But, you know, there was so much money. Borg and Lendl had a lot of success playing the Davis Cup. I remember Borg playing doubles with Ove Bengtsson. But then I'm just going to specialize. You know, that's where it was great to see Federer, who plays very little doubles, where he won a gold medal. With Wawrinka.
McEnroe
and Edberg.
McEnroe and Fleming were...
McEnroe and Fleming were a great team, for sure. With Fleming is one who was famous for saying, or I guess McEnroe's the famous player, but Fleming, he was top 10 in the world. He was number 9 in the world at one time in singles, but he said the best doubles team in the world is John McEnroe and anybody. With a lot of humility in that comment, but with... Oh, you just think about doubles in volleying. Martina won at age 50. Well, that's a compliment to her. She won on the pro tour at age 50.
Yeah.
But that's an insult.
A grand slam.
Lisa Raymond from, you know, I know quite a few people who know Lisa Raymond. Dennis Alter, Julian Krinsky. She was a young kid. And she played for Andy Brandy at Florida. And... Bryan brothers, they used to always put their money in one bank account, you know, and they got married and that changed a little bit. But I think it was Bob. It was one picking on the other. Bob telling Mike, you know, that's not all your money because I play mix with Lisa Raymond. So they called her money. And they've done very well at the University of Florida, women's tennis. They won NCAA titles, but they play one up, one back. And I just don't understand that. If I was the coach, I would say, sit down. You're a freshman. The romance period's over. The wine and dine in you through the recruiting process. Sit down. We're going to teach you how to play doubles. You're going to be here 4 years. And you're going to serve and go. Because, you know, she's won so many grand slams. But that's always puzzling to me. It's like with Federer, you think about going forward. You know, here's a quote for Federer. When you go to the net, good things happen. He said after Wimbledon, it's frightening how low the level of play here is. I know that less than 2% of the time, my opponents are going to follow their serve to the net.
So he just chips back.
But
I mean, it goes back to, you know, all the way up to the highest levels of the game. It just goes back to players don't know the dimensions of the court. They don't know those angles. They don't know the statistics behind it. And then obviously growing up, not getting the instincts, not getting the reps doesn't help. But if they just understood the court and the geometry and the statistics behind it.
Oh, you think about people you've already interviewed, Richard Nannis, help tennis in your country. First thing he said was grips. David Anderson, you know, the ready position. Put the racket in the ready position, center the racket. When you watch people return serve and you see how they have the racket to the offside, it's a safe bet that they're going to play a swing volley. You know, they're waiting in the ready position, the grip's on four, racket face is closed, it's not centered, it's not in a neutral position between the forehand and backhand.
They're not ready to take the ball out of the air.
they should be watching Djokovic. You know, and our listeners could say, well, Djokovic doesn't come in much. I remember Chrissy Everett asking him, you're winning so easily. Don't you think you should come in more? And that's from a player with such a great baseliner.
Yeah.
He one time, it was 253 points. It was a losing effort, a marathon against Wawrinka and the Australian. It was 253 points, and he finally hit a serve and came to the net.
Yeah. I actually saw a picture of him today from the finals. In London, he was hitting a backhand volley, arm straight, out in front, racket head up, 45-degree angle. Step and swing going together. He's in the air, left arm's back, hand-to-hand forms a line. I mean, all the checkpoints were there. I just put this whole picture up.
Yeah, the listeners, biomechanically, at the impact point, the players cannot violate physical laws. 90-95% the same, where they are at the impact point.
Yeah.
One year, he won the Australian, and he said to Mr. Laver, he addressed him as Mr. Laver. He said, I know I need to go to the net more. Yeah. I'm working on it.
All the years, you know, with Vic Braden at Indian Wells at the BNP tournament, before that was the Pacific Life Open. You know, we spent a lot of time together in the media room interviewing the players, and Vic loved that. And he would ask them about, you know, net play quite often. And they would usually say, or if he said, you know, what are you working on? It was usually an approach out in a volley. You know, players know they need to do that more.
Yeah.
But
well, yeah, with Federer, you read about Federer is that he will tell you that he liked or he trusted his forehand more than his volleys.
Yeah.
I remember Bill Jacobson telling Lendl that he was so successful at the net, but he didn't trust it. Because a lot of times people are not managed by stats. They're not just being told over and over again. It's coming around a little bit, the tennis analytics.
Yep.
And as we've said before with tennis math, the tennis analytics that are missing is people are not, you know, they're saying, oh, okay, your service percentage or the first four shots and da-di-da-di-da.
Yeah.
But they're not giving them the math for the grips.
Grip, swing, and body.
Yeah.
No, exactly.
Here's a story with Moya, coach of Nadal. He's younger than Alex Krejci. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Krejci was two in the world. Got the French Open twice, the finals twice.
Yep.
He's older, so he's hitting with a young Moya. And he motioned for Moya to come up to the net to hit some volleys, and Moya refused. So for our listeners, I mean, if someone hasn't been going to the net, it's not like they can never go to the net. So, I mean, Moya went on. And, you know, obviously he was not known as an all-court player, but become one of the best players in the world, he could go forward.
I think that's where it's tough. It's deceiving. It's confusing. You know, he's number one in the world. But, you know, I guess you just go, well, you know, how many Grand Slams do you want to win? Or, you know, what's the kid who've done more?
Well, the players, I mean, when it comes to nutrition and fitness, they're much better than they used to be. Yeah. Are they tougher? No. I mean, they're not playing three events. They used to have to play three events just to survive, you know, play the mixed, play all three of the Grand Slams.
Hey, it takes a lot to make a TikTok video. So I understand. So, I mean, they're working hard, just not on the right.
Why don't you comment though? One of the things that is different is how much time in between shots. Why don't you make a comment on that?
I remember, this is maybe 2009 or 10. Vic Braden and I, we had a group of kids that we were training to coach, and they did a little project. I think it was from the semifinals or finals of the Australian Open where they measured the time in between shots. And whereas before it was 3 or 4 seconds with the wooden rackets, I think four, it was down to 2.2 for the men and 2.5 for the women. And that was in 2010, you know, in the semis or finals. So in the later rounds where obviously, they can all play, but, you know, these are the best players in the world. So you don't have that much time to react. I mean, 2.2 seconds. A 70-mile-an-hour shot gets from baseline to baseline in 1 second.
Yeah.
So, you know, the players on average are hitting between 65, 75.
No, and I know the pros talk about how much, the surface, the balls, the rackets, the strings have changed.
Yeah.
So I can agree that, all right, there's going to be less net play.
Yeah.
But I cannot agree that there's going to be no net play.
Yeah. You know, doubles for people serving and staying back, especially if you're, you know, an Isner or a Query, somebody like that. But, you know, if you don't grow up doing it.
Yeah. Well, both of those players have problems with their grips, too. I mean, as far as angle the racket face.
Yeah.
And we say that. It's not like, okay, we're saying that Query has to change his game or Isner has to change their game. But if you could turn the clock back,
right.
You know, Andy Roddick, I mean, if anybody's ever watched him practice, he's going to yell out, I can't volley.
Yeah. It's for the future generation.
Yeah.
And that's the other part. It's like, well, okay, let's say Sam Querrey is your favorite player. And so you're out at the Indian Wells tournament or wherever, and you're watching, and he's going to hit some volleys. And he's a pro. He's hit a billion tennis balls. He'll be able to volley, but not to a point where he's going to use that and go to the net a ton.
Well,
so it's just confusing because people go, well, I my favorite player is doing this. So I'm going to do it like my favorite player.
Right now, and those two guys that you mentioned, they played some doubles together. When you're that big and serving that big, you should be able to volley behind the ball.
Yeah.
But if you don't, you don't.
Yeah.
But I think the word mandatory in stage development, young players, it should be mandatory to serve volley.
Yeah.
I think governing bodies of tennis, even changing the scoring system where, you know, if you win a point off a volley or an overhead, you get 2 points.
Yeah.
Anything to have the players go forward.
Right. Have some fun with it. Ghost doubles.
I tell players, first of all, ghost doubles, why don't you elaborate?
No, I think ghost doubles, you know, where you play half court, cross court, that would be fun for a junior. It's like, hey, ghost doubles tournament, you know, where you just play cross court and it could be mandatory to serve and volley on your first serve or first and second.
No, in the 70s, my older brother was the assistant coach of the New York Rangers, so I had access to the Felt Forum. The Masters were played in Madison Square Garden. And Frew McMillan and Bob Hewitt, you know, that's where, for me, it was like, okay, this is one-on-one, cross-court, whatever you want to call it, ghost doubles. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they got to the point where they're, you know, in their early 40s and they're, you know, one of the best teams in the world. Mm-hmm. One bounce doubles, we tell coaches of juniors every day you should play some one bounce doubles.
Yeah.
With balls that are hit right at you, to put a kid up against a fence and say, I'm going to feed balls at you. And then you just bring the basket on wheels, bring the basket closer and closer and closer.
Yeah.
And they do feel like a goalie. When you're at the net, you move with the ball and you're protecting what's behind you.
Yeah.
And obviously, you don't want a player to get hit in the eye. You know, there's not many injuries in tennis. I mean, lots of sprained ankles. But as you said earlier, not to be afraid of the ball.
As far as injuries, as far as getting hit with the ball.
Yeah, right, hit with the ball. I mean, I used to tease and say, okay, this is a Russian drill. And I have a kid put the racket down, put their hands behind their back, and I feed balls, and they have to stop, not feeding the ball like a rocket, but they have to stop the ball like they're playing soccer, and they're stopping the ball with their chest.
Yeah.
They just have to get in front of it and stop it.
Yeah.
And this is many years ago. I said, okay, this is a East German. And just then they turn around and I would just tease and start ripping the ball. But I mean, I grew up playing ice hockey where you're trying to block a puck.
Yeah.
I mean, the volley, okay, tennis is difficult, but it's not like you're doing a backflip on a balance beam.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, the other thing too is, you know, language. Can you tell a kid, you know what happens to chickens is chickens get eaten.
Yeah.
You know, don't be a coward. Go to the net.
Yeah.
But they don't hear that type of – most kids in our country, the U.S., they don't hear that type of language.
No, not at all.
Because they're a customer and you want them to come back.
Yeah.
And you're only half a tennis player if you can play only on half a court.
Yeah.
You're only half a tennis player if you can only play singles. You have to be able to play singles and doubles. You have to play on both sides of the court.
Yeah. It reminded me of when you're talking about the drill where you're hitting them. It reminds me of the movie Happy Gilmore where, you know, he fails at the tryout and then he's out and –
the hockey tryout.
The hockey tryout. Then he plays the Waterbury Open or whatever. And there's that scene where he goes and he's in the batting cage. And he's
right.
You know, the kid comes out and he just goes in there, you know, excuse me. And he's just, oh, yeah, bring that. Oh, yeah, that feels good, you know. And he's just getting hit. But I think to get over that fear, it's a good drill. Just like, we're going to start just real easy. Let the ball hit you. And it's like, okay, you're going to be fine. I used to do a lot of rock climbing and that was one thing, you know, you just to take some falls where, okay, you know, you're on a lead climb, you're going to go up, and if you're 10 feet past the last clip, you're going to fall 20 feet or more if there's slack. But if you just take a few of those whippers, a few of those falls, then after a while, you go, okay, I'm gonna survive. It's not that bad.
With baseball batting cage, Happy Gilmore. To digress, Steve Young.
Okay,
he worked with me for as a student for 2 years, and he hung around for three more because he got a more advanced degree, so an associate to a bachelor's. But he was working for Nick Baldieri, and he was with Andre Agassi and Aaron Krigstein. And Steve was just driving. You know, it was like, hey, take these guys over, bring them back, and you know, Krigstein, you know, he's got on his Detroit Tigers cap, and Agassi's just wanted to maybe get away from the campus. But so there's a baseball batting machine, and Agassi just says, turn it up as fast as it'll go.
Yeah.
And everybody just stopped and looked at him, and he just started running in, swinging the baseball bat like it was a tennis racket, just hitting every ball perfectly right out of the air.
Ripping.
But Mike Agassi, people should read his book before they read Andre's, because his came out first. And again, Baldieri did so many great things, but what he did is he worked with generally with players' strengths more than just their, and you got to work on both. Yeah. He really got to work on your strength versus your weakness. And Mike Agassi was upset that Nick did that. He wanted him to develop more of an all-court game. And then when it came down to his head-to-head against Sampras, it was a difference maker.
Yeah. No, ST brain type. I mean, he's got those fine motor skills, hand-eye coordination, all the dexterity. Andre.
And we'll write that down. We need to do the podcast on
we'll
the brain.
We'll talk about brain typing one of these.
Let's do it next time. Let's go with, because we've already said it a couple of times, Fitzell.
No, not
come on,
next
team.
Time.
Not next time?
I think we're going to talk about a pillar next week.
Next week about a pillar. We have eight pillars for our great base. Let's talk about college tennis. About 25% of the top doubles players, ATP, you know, it's a safe bet that when you're watching a pro doubles match, high level, one out of four played college tennis.
Yeah.
Because college tennis starts with doubles.
Yeah.
It's so, so important.
Doubles point. We played a pro set when I played college tennis.
You know, what's interesting, we're talking about Wimbledon. I don't think that the top players train year-round like they're going to play at Wimbledon. I know the grass, they've changed it slower, but they don't train year-round like, okay, Wimbledon's going to come around.
Yeah.
You know, you can't prepare for it for the 2 weeks before. You know, when Lendl skipped the French, he didn't listen to Tony Roach. Tony Roach was coaching him, and he said, your problem is you have too much ego and too much greed. You want to be number one, and you want to make a lot of money.
Yeah.
He said, you've won everything but Wimbledon. Yeah. You need to go forward and serve in volley. No matter where you are, what surface, just go.
365 days.
Yeah.
Give it a shot.
He didn't do that. But
This
is something that parents should know, that college coaches, I really feel badly for them, because when a freshman shows up, and it's not just players from the U.S., players from all over the world, when they show up to play college tennis, they're ill-prepared. They don't know how to play doubles. My son Connor, he played little doubles, and people used to compliment him on how he could play doubles.
Yeah.
Well, one, he could volley, but two, he would say, well, I'm not that great a doubles player, but I know where to stand. I said, you know, that's a great answer. You should add to it. Why don't you say, I can play a little bit of doubles because I know, at least I know where to stand. Plus, I know how to hang on to the racket, how to center the racket, how to position the racket.
No, Connor, volleys.
With.
I still.
Go ahead.
With Connor, with your son. Probably once a month, maybe not so much now, but once a month I would just ask him, you know, did you watch some of that doubles on TV? You could come back right now and go, you know, just let's come out and start training and you could for sure play some doubles.
I worked for Robbie Saguzzo. I'm much older, but I've known Robbie since he was 10 years old. And I was hired to run his academy. And he owned, with his wife, Carly Bassett, which is now Chris Edwards.
Yeah,
he was number one in the world in doubles for 5 years.
Yeah,
and this is before Brad Gilbert was famous. Gilbert would call up, and we got to the point with another investor, actually the investor, Arthur Cohen. He loved it. He was a tennis groupie. And so it got to the point where five or six of us were working in the office. Dave Anderson worked with me, and he was in the beginning stages. He was on the court making things work, and I was in the office trying to make things work. But Brad Gilbert would call Saguzzo up every Monday and say, how fat are you now? You know, and he said, you need to get your lazy da-da-da-da back out here. Do you know who's winning doubles?
Yeah.
with I think one thing to mention with college tennis is a freshman rule change. I have three older brothers. When they went to college, they could not play varsity sports as a freshman. By the time I went in 73, so I'm pretty sure the rule took place in 72. So Stan Smith, Arthur Ashe, Wimbledon champions. Stan Smith, if people read about Stan Smith, he'll tell you that George Foley really taught him how to play at the net. Mm. So his freshman year, he goes to college. Just imagine that. He goes to college and he can't play.
Yeah.
And until his next year. What many of the top American kids do is they say, hey, no, hey, coach, I'll come and join you in January. Yeah. I'll play one semester, then I'm done.
Yeah.
And, you know, someone that we coached to coach for years, Craig Tiley, we used to run a program called College Prep. And you could, years ago, the rules were different. You could take a postgraduate year. You know, you went to high school for 4 years and you weren't quite good enough to go to the college, and they'd take a year off. Now that rule has changed, and kids are taking the gap year in the eighth grade.
Yeah.
Now, and the rules vary in college tennis in the States, where from one sport to the next. But when you play tennis, once you start high school, you have 4 years to graduate. And, you know, even when kids sign college tennis, they signed, they're going to college. They have their scholarship.
Yeah.
You know, like someone just this week that we've worked with for a long, long time, Spencer Johnson, he signs at UCLA, which is a big deal.
Yep.
And, you know, he can go forward and he can volley.
Yeah.
But say, for example, someone signs and they, okay, you're good enough to get a scholarship. You've signed. Why don't you right now just rebuild your game until you go to school?
Yeah.
A lot of parents especially should know that there's so many kids that are recruited and the coaches recruit the player knowing that they can play in the bottom of the lineup. And most kids who play in the bottom of the lineup at a major college, men and women, is they're just going to grind it from the baseline. They're going to always play six. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe they'll get the 4-0 in accounting or whatever. They're going to always play six. So they'll represent the team as a student. But then as a player, they can put points on the board in singles. Yeah. And they don't even think about them playing doubles in college. And that's true with, say, like a Michael Chang years ago.
Yeah.
A great tennis player. But when he was on, when he was playing Davis Cup, it was like, no, we're not going to ask you to play doubles. Yeah. But I think that that's something that's just crazy where if you play doubles, it will improve your singles. It will improve your singles.
Yeah, exactly.
Here's something on volleying. For 10 years, I was in charge of a junior college tennis team. And 5 years, Chad Burial, first year we helped him out, but then he really had autonomy and it was his program.
Yeah.
But the rules allowed the program to be interfaced with our junior program.
Yeah.
And we had a rule where, okay, you can't play if you got a palm up serve. You can't play if you get a serve and stay back.
Yeah.
You know, this is not 3-5 ladies doubles. But Chad would be the one to verify this. Was it not one girl left? You know, he won the national championship. I think his team was the 5 years he was there. 3 out of the 5 years was in the final.
Yeah.
Might have been 4, but I bet it was 3. They only went it once. But all the players that left there to go on to other schools, every girl was told they have to stay back.
Yeah.
They have to stay back. Yeah. You only learn by making mistakes.
Spending all that time getting new skills that they can't use them.
It's like the Williams sisters. They've done really well in doubles, and they played a lot of one up, one back. So what that is it's superior athletes playing an inferior system.
Yeah.
That's where winning's confusing. They could have been even better if they played doubles where they served and went forward more. Yeah.
And they played a lot of swing. You know, they play a lot of swinging volleys, which we've seen those old tapes of them. When they were 7, 8, 9 years old and they're hitting swinging volleys.
When the swinging volley years ago was like taboo, somebody would hit a swinging volley, kind of look around and go, that's wrong.
Yeah.
But you have to thank Agassi for that. When Agassi came on the scene, he could not play a conventional volley. He was just radical. And the name of the racket he was using, the radical.
Yeah.
He swung at everything.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's where Balotelli, Jimmy Aries tells a story is that, this kid's going to, you know, he's saying about Agassi, this kid's going to be great. Because he's just ripping everything. And Agassi goes, he's going to be great. He's hitting the fence. The balls are going everywhere. You got to duck when you're on the court next to him.
Yeah.
But you have a much better chance of having the racket face be correct by swinging fast and swinging slow.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many myths on volleys. One is the stop. Stop for more control.
Yeah.
When you stop, why don't you elaborate a bit on that? What happens when you stop?
Yeah, well, we talk about it a lot of time, and this, you know, really comes back to my time with Vic Braden, but he used to always say, you know, he would relate it to putting the brakes on the car, that when you stop a car abruptly, the front end goes down and the back end goes up. So if you stop before the hit, your body's going to go forward and down along with it, the racket, so that, you know, you're going to end up hitting in the net a lot. So you really want to move through the volley. Number one, momentum, source of power. Number two, you can get closer to the net, get a higher ball, and then also more angle. But the momentum, source of power, did I mention that? I did. And then obviously just keeping the flight path of the racket steady, you know, linear.
There's a book called Eight to Be Great.
Not pulling down.
Eight to Be Great. There's eight key words. We do a drill where one player is just tossing underhand. They start on the service line. It's predictable. Partner drill. Toss underhand to the forehand volley. They just glide. They come. They move in. They look like Sampras.
Yeah.
And with that, one's emotional quotient. You know, you look like $1 million out there. Of course, granted, they know where the ball is going to be. The ball's being tossed to them underhand.
Yeah.
But they don't do that. So when someone hits a high, I mean, we call it the wounded duck. Mm-hmm. Some guys, gal, they've hit a ball. It's just floating up there like a wounded duck.
Yeah.
Talk about the volley, but the conventional volley is a lost art. You can go to a tournament weekend after weekend. Are you going to see someone come in and go, I'm taking that ball out of the air?
Yeah.
The volley, first volley is an approach volley, so that's the money shot. The next one, we close in. When you're up at the net, we just divide it from the service line in. 10.5 feet up, call it the green zone, get a ball above the level net. That's when you close in. That's when you put the ball away.
Yeah.
But most of the time in tennis, what you're doing is you're hitting the ball back to where they are.
Yeah.
You know, you certainly can spread the court, but most kids make so many mistakes doing that. They're running around their backhand, and they're way behind the baseline.
Yeah.
So that's where the tennis court becomes like a aircraft carrier.
Yeah.
But if you play the court correctly, it's as if you make it smaller. It's like, well, it feels like a postage stamp. Mm-hmm. But if you're always running east and west, and the court, the net is to the north or to the south, you're going the wrong way. about numbers, you know, so we could say, okay, you know, you could measure the speed of the movement forward. You can measure the angle of the racket face, the path of the racket.
Yeah.
Those things can be measured. But I find, having been around ATP pros, the numbers they talk about, I've got some written in my notes here, fantasy football, the ATP pension.
Yeah.
Talk about business. Here's another number they talk about. The lower ranked players is the cutoffs. Can they get into such and such tournament?
For sure.
Are they in the main draw? Do they have to go to qualies?
Yeah.
But I'd say the most importantly about the numbers is really, it's just not discussed. It's not understood that there are numbers involved.
Yeah.
You know, well, what do you mean if you don't change the grip, you have to change the wrist?
Yeah.
And you could be fine changing the wrist. Nadal, McEnroe said he's the best volleyer in tennis. Well, he closes in so well. He's so athletic.
Yeah.
As you said, he's
pretty much on an Eastern. I mean,
yeah, he's flatter on the forehand side, backhand side, it's open. So he has to go down, and you can look on YouTube where there's lots of films of him flubbing a backhand volley.
Yeah.
It's not that it's wrong. It's a higher degree of difficulty. Yeah. It's more variables, variables to calculate.
Got to calculate. You know, back to grips just a little bit. You know, someone asked about a grip the other day, and you're going to see all kinds of combinations, you know, where you're going to have base index knuckle on 2.5 and heel pad on 1.5, you know, more of a motorcycle grip or a fisted grip. So you're going to see all kinds of variations with a heel pad and the knuckle.
Yeah. You know, well, it's like when someone, you know, goes to have their palm read, you just tell by the lines in your hand, you know, it's really the length of your fingers. There's a funny story. It's an internal scar. I grew up playing ice hockey, so basketball was not my thing. But I'm palming a basketball in the sixth grade. And this basketball coach goes, Smith, put that basketball down. So I put it down nervously, pick it up with two hands. He goes, no, over here. So I pick it up, he goes, pick it up with one hand. I pick it up with one hand. He goes, that's the only ounce of athletic ability you have. So everybody's grip is different. So that's where, the size of the grip they use, and there's personal preference. But when it comes down to mechanics, though, you have to deal with the angle of the racket face.
Right. But so, yeah, with the grips that we teach, composite grip on the forehand side and then the right side of one for the backhand side. But it's, we're going to generally line people up with the heel pad and then and the base index knuckle on those panels. But there are players that, slide the heel pad only. I mean, there's all kinds of different variations when you look at the top players.
Right. And when it comes down to, Andy mentioned it earlier, I've heard Sampras, Rosewall, and they're asked what grip do they use, and they just kind of grab the right, use this one. So they get to a certain point, just like the saxophone player, where they're not going to articulate, well, this is how I do it.
Yeah.
But we talked about that earlier with, if you want to find out how Roger Federer was taught as an 8-year-old, ask his mother, don't ask him.
Exactly. Another number. I mean, I heard you say 10.5 feet in numbers. Not necessarily with the stroke, but having a vertical racket face and swinging flat from the 10.5-foot mark, you can hit 50 miles an hour from a 4-foot height flat. The ball will stay in, so gravity. So you don't have to worry about, when the ball's above the level of the net, people are afraid to go out and really hit through the volley because they think it's going to go long. But gravity will bring it in at 50, and then just behind the service line, you can hit 70 miles an hour flat from a 4-foot height.
So yeah, I told you
really deck the volley.
I was telling some kids today, really what you want to do, you always hear at their feet, but what you want to do is aim at their chest.
Yeah.
One that's going to allow the racket to be on a linear path going across that table.
Have an air target.
But then gravity takes the ball down.
Yeah. And people still see their target through the net. They feel like they can hit down, so it's best to have an air target. I think it was Billie Jean King said that for a deep volley, she would aim at people's throats.
I've heard that. Yeah. Oops. Billie Jean King, she wanted, and it should have happened, where it would be more tennis played. Boys and girls could play, say, in the 12s, up to the 12s, through the 12s. Boys and girls could play in the same age. They don't have to play, all the boys play each other, all the girls play each other. Just have more matches be played.
Yeah.
But Arthur Ashe used to call her the old lady. I had a chance to see her play at Wimbledon. She could play. She went all the way to Australia to take lessons from Mervyn Rose and to work on her forehand. She didn't go down there to play tournaments. She went on the other side of the world to work on her forehand. Mm. And she came back and told everybody, my forehand's awesome. My forehand's awesome. And it was a bluff. And she said, my forehand. I'm still struggling with my forehand. But that's one of the reasons that people went forward, not only the wooden rackets and the grass, but Chris Ever came on the scene, and she's been quoted as said, when I came up, nobody could hit ground strokes.
Yeah.
Everybody was serving a volley.
Yeah.
So, that's one thing that's really improved where, so many players had a continental grip on the forehand side.
Or the Australian grip.
Yeah.
Composite. They rolled the forearm.
But, Laver, he revolutionized tennis hitting topspin, and he had an inefficient grip. Just all that means is more calculation.
Yeah.
You have to really take the palm down, pushing it down like you're dribbling a basketball.
Yeah.
With ranking systems, Billie Jean King, speaking of her, she wanted to have one level. In other words, it wasn't the top player in singles and the top player in doubles. It was just combined. Mm. They could have said, okay, we'll have singles, we'll have doubles, and we'll have a combined.
Yeah.
In junior tennis, the USTA, Bobby Curtis, great guy, he ran junior tennis. He's retired now. We ran junior tennis forever. Tournaments, not just junior tennis tournaments, but tournaments in Florida. And going back to, so I've known him since the 70s. And there was a point in Florida tennis where it was one weekend a month was designated just for doubles. Great idea, but people didn't go. Mm. We'll take that weekend off. Yeah. And then another thing, I think it was 15%, maybe it was 10, but it was a very small percentage. It was like, okay, you're going to be able to boost your singles ranking if you do well in doubles. But that's where tennis doesn't have one commissioner. It's like, okay, I think coming back to trench pros, that's where trench pros, people who know the game from teaching and coaching, they should be in those meetings.
Yeah.
How can we get kids to play better doubles? And that comes back to the volleys. One thing about, I know you spent 4 years living in Germany. We have a young boy here who can speak German. with...
I just spoke Russian. I said da.
Da, da. So it reminds me of junior tennis in Germany. Actually, that's one plus that we have in the States. It's a juniors doubles is a little bit better because at least it's on hard court. In Europe, is this...
Yeah.
I mean, I know a lot of young players have come... They come out of college and it's like, well, if you want to be a double specialist, initially go to Europe because the wins will be a little bit easier playing doubles in Europe.
I mean, the indoor carpet, there is
a yeah, that's true.
Bad time.
But it's interesting with like the French system, there's so many players from the former Czechoslovakia, I think, okay, today the Czech Republic, but the former Czechoslovakia and Argentina, a lot of players that would go to France and play for money. So when you look at the ATP ranking, there's some people that aren't even thinking about playing because they know they lack skills.
Yeah.
One, everybody talks, well, I don't serve well enough to play at the highest level. But two is you don't have options. You know, you're just, you know, Vic Braden used to say that if you can only play the baseline,
yeah,
why don't you just mail in the scores? I was with Vic one time at the Easter Bowl. And he said, Steve, I mean, someone's a little better than you for the baseline, you might as well just mail in the scores because you have no options.
Yeah. So many matches with him. We talk about Vic all the time. But we would watch matches and, you know, you wouldn't flat out say I'm bored, but it was just basically just, gosh, you know, they get the players so far off the court and they refuse to come to the net. You know, tennis is about intimidation, you know. Learn to come to the net, especially when they're in an outstretched, vulnerable position. Just that ability to come in and play a mid-court volley.
You know, California at one time, the hard courts, it wasn't that they were asphalt-based. They're all in concrete. And wow, was that fast. One time at the Vic Braden Academy, I went to it an even 10 times. Now, you know, I worked for him in California, worked for him in Europe, traveled all over doing clinics with him.
USTA.
But, yeah, it was the USTA when the USTA was the USLTA. The United States Tennis Academy. So I had a group of 10 career-minded coaches with me, and Bill Jacobson was there at CompuTennis and said, okay, for the academy, we're going to play, have one set be played. And said, Steve, why don't you give us your best two players? And anyway, we had two baseliners play. And they went in the room, and Vic and Bill Jacobson, you can't meet two nicer people. And they were like, guys, you know, you don't hit a ball and run the other way. I mean, you got to go forward. Yeah. On brain typing, we'll come back and have a podcast on that. But one thing I have written down is the P's and the J's. The P's are the perceivers. J's are structured.
Yeah.
Judgers. So with that, you can elaborate on that a little bit. But like, I think of Stan Smith and Chris Evert, both ISTJs.
Yeah.
And J's have a tendency to learn things out of routine. They just have to do it over and over and over again. So you really do need to know how someone's wired. The kid who's a P, who's more flexible.
Risk taker.
Yeah, risk taker.
Yeah.
Yeah, why don't you comment on that a little bit?
No, I think the P's see the field spatially a little bit more, like a lot of famous quarterbacks or they have the P, where if their man is covered, they're going to be like, okay, that guy's covered, I'll find somebody else. Whereas a J is going to not adapt so well, but a P is going to be more of a risk taker and can kind of go with the flow and adapt in situations and see the field peripherally better than a J would.
Let's talk a little bit about drills for volleys. You have to acquire the skill, and then you have to drill. So first it's the will to get the skill and then drill before the thrill. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem with video games. A kid plays a video game and they get the thrill right away.
Yeah.
So we mentioned one bounce doubles, one bounce singles. I like to have kids play sets where someone, you just know they're just going to dominate from the baseline. Say, all right, in the first set, you can have three bounces. That's it. Ball bounces the fourth time.
Yeah.
You can customize it, design it for each individual player. But then, okay, second set, first set. And you get to the point where they're, okay, they went three bounces, two bounces, one bounce.
Yeah.
And it's like, whoa, one bounce. They have to be drilled. They have to be trained to go forward.
Yeah.
I mentioned awarding points differently, maybe double point for a volley or an overhead.
Yeah.
A great drill is to have kids keep their own score. Two people are playing, A playing B, and it's not, okay, how are you doing for A versus B? It's just your own number. If you win a point in the forecourt, it's a plus three. If you lose up there, it's a minus one.
Yeah.
And in the middle of the court, it's a plus two, minus two at the baseline. So if you win a point, you know, you hit the dumb shot down the line from the way behind the baseline and you hit a winner, it's a plus one. But if you miss it, it's a minus three. But, you know, those are the things. I mean, it'd be great if tennis courts, maybe a hard court, one court at a facility would be painted. Okay, this is the red zone. This is the yellow zone. This is the green zone. Because, you know, we're all day long, we're telling kids, you came in from the wrong zone.
Yeah.
You didn't close into the green zone. I mean, it's really like tic-tac-toe, one, two, three. I mean, is it that complicated? But they pick up their racket, they reduce their IQ in half, and they're just going, I want to win, I want to win, I want to win, I want to win.
I think anything half court, you know, half court straight ahead, and then they can start to see, okay, if I go forward, I have more angle. You know, I can finish when I go up to the net. You can't do that so easy when you stay back.
I think of a young girl, we changed her game. We have it on film. I mean, she was a Ferrari, Julie Scott. She never really learned to serve that well.
Although that before and after of her overhead is
powerful. Too. Yeah, it's very powerful. I mean, but she was a Ferrari.
Yeah.
Her brother, who didn't sign up for, you know, oh, I'm not doing that. He was like the best athlete that ever came around. And he ended up, I understand he's a physician now, and he played at Abilene Christian, but what a specimen he was. His mother couldn't get him to get in line and drop hit balls or shadow swing. But Julie, I just said, you know, if you miss wide, you lose the game. And, you know, so we play singles on a full court.
Yeah.
And then we play singles on half a court. It was a great drill. It's 13 and a half feet. No alleys. You can do it where there's no lobs. Mm-hmm. You can do it where only the server comes in. You can do it where they serve underhand. And so there's no passing shots.
Yeah.
You just go up there, and your volley needs to be like the Rock at Gibraltar. Right. A great drill is to just one player is at the net, start right at the service line. They can close in. But if they hit their volley anywhere, say in the net, long, wide, in the alleys, in the service boxes, they have to move back. But if they can keep the volley, they project it outwards between the service line and the baseline, they can stay up there and hold the net. We do the same thing with a lob and overhead. Just a courtesy lob, like in the warm-up, and you get to stay at the net as long as you keep hitting overheads.
Yeah.
It's very important to do drills where you can cut out the verbiage. It's like, no, you're going to be jogging backwards. You're going to come up, your racket's going down, the ball's going short.
Yeah.
And now you got to jog backwards. Your turn's up. You want to stay up there, keep your racket up.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think everyone in tennis, there's so many things that people disagree upon, but keeping the racket head above the wrist.
I saw this morning, you know, watching the kids that are doing triples, you know, just everybody moving quick, just to get things
going. Six-player doubles. You can hit more balls playing six-player doubles than you can with four. You can do it with a serve. But this morning, you get out there when the sun comes up and put three players on one side, three players on the other, and you just put the ball playing underhand and everybody go. The
approach is good. It's great.
We used to call it rat-a-tat-tat. It's actually on one of our courses, Vic Braden's favorite drill. Two people, one-on-one, you just feed it and go right at each other, and you try to make each other look like a donut.
Yeah.
Just fuzz, come in.
The fuzz sandwich.
The fuzz sandwich.
The Wilson tattoo.
Mini tennis three, we do that.
Yep.
Where you play in one service box, you have to serve volley. Here's a Peter Burwash
straight
drill.
Straight ahead.
Right. Thanks. It's Peter Burwash, straight ahead. You play four players playing doubles in one service box. Dennis Vandermeer would take four players, great on a rainy day situation where you tight for space.
Yeah.
And you put the right in the alley. Players are on one side, or there's two of them, they're 4.5 feet apart. And on the other side, 4.5 feet apart. And you just volley. And you try to get a step in. And, you know, coming back to Oscar Wagner on the volley, move your feet, find the ball, just touch the ball.
Yeah.
You got to be careful if you do too much mini tennis because then. Especially in America, kids play mini tennis. They end up playing continental on everything.
Yeah,
you're playing too much, just finesse only to be able to drive it.
Yeah.
I like what you do with our tiebreaker test. You know, for the match, we tell people, all right, come in, get in close, and angle the volley. We just put a young kid through a tiebreaker test, and it's like putting someone through a reading test. Say, Mom, Dad, you know, the reading level. We got to go back to the alphabet.
Yeah.
And but you know, it's they can't hit six shots in a row, so there's 07-07. But I like it how you do it. We do it where it's related to a match at first, but you've changed it a little bit.
Just hold the line on the first one.
Yeah, the first just take the volleys deep. Take the volleys deep. First
volley deep, and then second close in.
Yeah. With tennis is a random sport. With you know, you can say, okay, let's hit cross courts, you know, down the lines, but you eventually have to play. And it's when you say random, it's not like, okay, I'm going to hit 10 forehands in a row.
Yeah.
Short-term memory, make a mistake. At least when you make a mistake on a volley, you're trying to do something to the ball. At least you're dictating the point. At least you're on offense.
Yeah.
You're not missing a routine ball. We mentioned the warm-up, only the traditional, you know, some players skipping that part of the warm-up. We mentioned this with Braden. People don't trust their volley or overhead. They don't value volleying position.
Yeah.
Bill Jacobson, the aggressive air margin. When it comes down to, do players understand stats? Are they managed by stats? You go to the net, 2 out of 3, 4 out of 6, 8 out of 12, 16 out of 24. Jack Kramer, not only did he know that Gonzalez is going to go cross court, but he also said that if I lose to someone with a continental grip, Jack Kramer, if I lose to someone with a continental grip, not that he did this, but if I lose to somebody with a continental grip, I'm going to go back to the hotel room and break all the furniture. One thing about Pancho Segura, Braden saw him, people arguably said he had the best shot in tennis, two-handed forehand.
Yeah.
But he was drop hitting balls, and like he was ripping it cross court to Gonzalez's volley, and then he'd sprint forward. And Vic said, "What are you going to do?" He goes, "I'm going to do that all day tomorrow."
Yeah.
He goes, "He has such a great serve, but I get a chance, I'm going to rip it at his forehand volley. I'm going to run right here."
Yeah.
And that's how you you just that one flaw.
Yeah.
Okay, this is how I can break Pancho Gonzalez. It's
so important just to even know grips. We've talked about that. You mentioned it again tonight with Richard Hernandez. Like if you. Reason why you want to know grip, swing, body is so you can look across the net and come up with a good strategic plan against whoever you're playing based on the way they hit the ball, the way they hold on to it.
You know, I think I see in your notes here, or the notes, Charlie Hollis, Coach Laver.
Yeah.
When I think of Charlie Hollis, I think of Vic Braden and Robert Lansdorp. Because Vic Braden for 7 years was at the Jack Kramer Tennis Club. Mm-hmm. And then when he resigned, Robert Lansdorp, who was very successful in San Diego, he moved up to L.A. and was a pro at the Kramer Club. And he also had so much success. I remember telling Elliot Telscher that so many things happened in his life. And Telscher, you know, he's a top 10 player a half dozen times anyway in the world. And it was great that they had Braden first and they had Lansdorp second, because that's really what you'd want. You know, someone that – you know, was here just today, and they spent time at Balotelli's. And I respect Balotelli's greatly. I mean, it's we said it with Rob Krajicek, whose son spent so much time there. You know, I remember working with Austin in Tampa one day on the tabletop return, and then the next day practice had a set with Karlovic.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can't really buy that type of experience.
Toughest playground in the world.
Yeah. So, but yeah, Charlie Hollis was the person who taught Laver, a friend of ours, David Squires, one of the last guys to take lessons from him. But yeah, he taught Laver, but then they had Hopman. So I think of Hollis being like Braden and Lansdorp being like...
the test master.
Lansdorp being... get it right here. Yeah, Hopman being like Balotelli.
Yeah.
I think I get that backwards. So we go slow. Senior Mo.
Let's try that again.
We got Hollis to Hopman. Is like Braden to Lansdorp. All right. Everybody get that?
Yeah, we got it.
All right. I messed it up a little bit. All right. Goes these six laws for volleying.
No, so
late Charlie Hollis.
You know, I didn't know much about Charlie Hollis, but a couple of years ago, I guess it is now or a year ago, I've done a little bit of work with Kimberly Burrell from Australia and her dad, John Burrell. And John was telling me about the six laws for volleying from Charlie Hollis. And number one, play the volley as far in front as possible. And I think that's good to play in front, but if you're too far in front, it can become a push. The body faces forward more, and the racket will have the tendency to go down. So you got to be careful with that. But you know, off the forehand volley, you want to be hitting about off the front shoulder, and then the backhand volley, one-handed, will be about 6 to 8 inches in front. So a little further in front than the forehand volley. But yeah, play the volley as far in front as possible. Never wait for the ball. Go forward and get it or meet the ball. So that's number two. Number three, keep the racket head above the wrist. Number four, make a brick wall with the racket. I like that one. So oftentimes we say, you know, make a wall with the racket face and then take the wall to the ball. But I like that word brick. Just make a solid brick wall with the racket. And then number five, never cut across the line of flight. Hit through the line. Again, makes sense. Path of the racket goes to the path of the target. And then number six, sit down to volley. So get low. And, you know, that makes me think about just ideally as a general rule, try to have your head, the racket head, and the ball at the same level. But I like those six laws for volleying. He had many other laws. I talked to John actually a little bit today, and he reminded me of one that I liked that he said, you know, the best players in the world get under the ball and then they belt it. So you get under it and belt it up. That's the line. Get under, belt it up. And then he said, and the best players in the world have a high finish because they get under and they belt it up.
Belt it up.
Yeah, I like that.
With, a couple of things. Backhand volley. I would say this is Peter Burwash lingo. On the forehand volley, start in a bent position, finish in a bent position. If you lengthen your arm out on the backhand volley, the racket face will open up. Lengthen your arm out on the forehand volley.
Yeah.
On the backhand volley, you want to go straight to straight, ideally. Now, the pros, they certainly, the aerodynamics to generate more racket hit speed. But you want to really volley from the shoulder. You want to have your, like you said, you want to be going with your legs.
Yeah.
One thing with...
well, just generally, too, I think with that, you know, I mean, there's all kinds of words used to describe the volley, a punch, a block, you know, it can be a swing as well, but really a momentum source of power. So you don't have to do so much with the racket, especially at a high level. But if you can get your body moving forward, you know, do it with your feet, do it with your legs. Keep the racket work simple.
Yeah, I used to tell kids, okay, you're going to the circus. You're going to be the clown. You're going to climb in the cannon. You want to land in the net. How do you want that cannon to be aimed? Do you want that cannon to be aimed this way, straight ahead? Are you going to be the laser, or you want them to loop you up and into that net?
Yeah.
I heard this about Sampras. No one will volley like him again because he was such a flat volleyer. And that's a mistake. I mean, how could you say that? No one will ever volley like Sampras again. With Robin Anderson played for UCLA, and she was very good. Her father taught her. I always want to say that is how I met Robin is one of our students, Alex Vukovic, who played at Princeton, you know, became a sparring partner. But then she, two different times, once her was when she was a last semester in high school. So she spent 4 months with us. So then, you know, actually a semester, so it's 16 weeks. Mm-hmm. And then a summer vacation where she was injured. And she's a very quiet girl, but I remember they were talking to her about her volley, and she said, well, let's film it. And they did. And they said, and she had hit with Pete, and they said, well, let's look at Pete's volley.
Yeah.
And again, people feel like the racket face is open.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can tell by the sound of the ball coming off the racket. So The physical characteristics are speed, spin, trajectory, but you could tell by the sound. Now, a lot of times kids that play indoors, they think they're better than they are because it's like an amphitheater.
Yeah.
Ba-boom, ba-boom. So, you know, when you come in, palm, you mentioned it, palm guidance on the forehand. On the backhand, it's knuckle guidance. One thing on the backhand volley is most players, you go to a Division I match on the men's side, and it's getting to the point where it's two out of three teams are playing one-up-one back.
Yeah.
I hate to be doom and gloom, but you know, last year, because of the pandemic, the NCAAs were not held. The year before, it's held in our backyards, played over at the national campus, 5.5 miles away. And, you know, somebody who you worked with, Max Cressy, he played the big guy, I think it's Keegan Smith.
Yep.
So they win it, but there were, and they were going and going and going. You know, they had too much racket play, you know, their, how they move the racket. They could be, you know, okay, let's go back to a few basics with volleying technique. Yeah, I know you worked with Max, but when it comes down to the, that's one thing with Robin Anderson. So when she, her father wanted her to stay on the East Coast and go to Duke, and she wanted to go to UCLA. So I was kind of the net with a little ping pong going on. And I remember saying to Stella, UCLA's got my vote as long as you tell me. And when she plays double, she's going to serve and volley both balls.
Yeah.
And, you know, but people want to win. People want to win. If someone plays with no volley, so you're going to serve and stay back, they do that as a freshman in high school, that's how they're going to play. Play the right way and learn by making mistakes. It's, I told this young kid today, you're 11, you double your life, you're 22, you triple your life, you're 33. You know, people ask us, how long is it going to take to change? And we say a little less than the ice age. Because if you think about how long is it going to be to take to change a stroke, then you're not thinking
not
about
thinking about
changing. You're not thinking about the change. You're thinking about how long it would take.
I thought with the you know, going back to the Robin and Stella Sampras, you know, they showed that tape of Pete, and it was kind of like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, okay.
No, I had some fun. I remember with David Anderson is that we were trying to, you know, Robbie Siguzo. That guy, I mean, I know his game. I mean, when he was 10, and then Jimmy O'Brien and Boca West started helping him, and, you know, how he went from a Western grip to, you know, the grip that he had on his forehand, which is just a little bit under the third panel, and how he hit his one-handed backhand. But, so, you know, at first, Robbie, you know, he wasn't on the court, but then there's... It was a financial situation where this mother-in-law wasn't, she's like, well, okay, I don't know if I'm going to support this. And it was, you know, where's the money going to come from? Mm-hmm. And this business and, you know, bricks and mortars, building a place is complicated. And so Robbie started showing up on the court. You know, for the, when he first got there, he wasn't on the court. And I can remember showing him, when you take slow motion and you show it in slow motion, even back in the old VHS days.
Yeah.
And we're watching Edberg and Sampras, which were, I have to go back. I mean, Sampras was a young guy when Robbie was playing. And I remember Robbie, you got to love this with players. Stubbornness. You know, stubbornness is a great thing if you have it work for you. I don't care. I don't care what I see on the film. I was there. I was courtside. And I thought, well, Robbie, I've been courtside watching you play. You know, this is how the human eye works.
Yeah.
There's a few more things. Curios, I was listening to a podcast, and Curios said, well, I'm taking some time off and I'm working on my game. And
I heard this, yeah.
And the person interviewed and said, well, when you come back, will you be serving volleying some? And you know, are you working on your volley? Which was like, I couldn't believe those questions were asked. You know, I do think that people get to a point where they don't really make changes in their game. Now, the players are going to improve because the ball comes, they go up a level, the ball comes deeper, faster, higher frequency, the players are more consistent, they start shortening their swing up. You know, I was watching Dominic Thiem today playing in London, and I think the way he plays indoors, you know, he did so well last year, that's the way he should play on clay. Yeah. I mean, he plays so much closer to the baseline. Yeah. So, I mean, that's a slight adjustment.
He's eliminated his swing on the forehand side. He's definitely
The closer you stay in,
deviate the racket.
The closer you stay in, the less time you'll have, and that'll help you clean up your strokes. Yeah. So when it comes down to change, because he has such a great serve.
Yeah.
You know, even Ivanišević is a funny guy, and he's a fun person to listen to. Playing doubles with a guy one time, they said, "What do you think about playing with him?" And he goes, first time, last time, and never again. But even Ivanišević, you know, he used to call himself, he goes, yes, I'm a serve and no volley player. But, you know, and you know, think about how he was playing. You know, he beat Rafter in that famous Wimbledon match. You know, he's turning and, you know, Rafter, I mean, he's such a great athlete, came in, but he's, you know, really it's like he had 2 second serves because he used to arch his back so much.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's a one positive with that. If you're taking speed off a serve, if you can get closer in.
Right.
You know, at Wimbledon years ago, you could see where the players were serving volleying, and they call it the run-up. Where yeah. they, now there's no run-up. The players are not. Less. Yeah, now the players are not wearing.
Yeah, it looks so different.
Pass out. American tennis, we talked in the past about Taylor Fritz and Francis Tiafoe, great players. Not that this is something straight across the board with all players, but with those two, I think some people would agree that their whole game is, like so many players, built upon a weakness. And if you don't have a strong backhand volley, right, it's like Roger Federer says, if you don't volley well, you're yeah. not looking to go forward.
Yeah, exactly.
And but then, you know, the why, and it just comes back to grip, swing, body. It mm-hmm. just comes back to the math, you know, how they're hanging onto the racket.
And why would you want to? Is this options, you know? You're going to play somebody that is better than you off the ground that day, and you need to have plan B.
Yeah, I mentioned Paul Roeder when we talked to Rob Krajicek, and now he's back with the USTA. It's his third stint with the USTA now. And I just remember telling him back when Sam Querrey was young, I said, the Sam Querreys of the future don't need to volley, you know, with the grip system that he has.
Yeah.
So kids need to get a better start. There are serve and volleyers. You know, I think Lopez, he's the same age as Federer. He's still out there.
Yeah.
Pretty solid. There's not too many. Karlovic.
And he's got some downplay on his volleys.
Some. You're being
especially
nice.
On the backhand side. Again, goes back to the grip.
I mean, he's all set to be a lumberjack. I mean, he's hacking it on both sides. I mean, he hacks at it more on the backhand side. But
the thing is, I mean, if you're serving from a tree and you can get a little sitting duck, you know, okay, you might do okay. But you'd think a guy like that, if he could just volley well, could win Wimbledon 9 times.
Now, I didn't see your Instagram post today or the day before. You're telling me the magic trick when your elbow's in.
Yeah.
You just raise your elbow. Vic used to say, just pretend you're having a beer at the bar. You know, that's why Australians can volley. They spend a lot of time at the bar.
You're not going to feel, this isn't going to feel comfortable unless you spend a lot of time at the bar.
Yeah. With, you know, to have kids be like this and then say, okay, now just see if you can just toss a ball and have it. It's like a basketball. Can they toss a ball in this area? I mean, you can put a basketball in here. I know coaches will get a beach ball and say, now you need to volley this way.
Yeah.
One of our students years ago developed a teaching aid where he had suspenders holding up a piece of cardboard. It just came out this way and you had to volley like this.
Yeah. No, I mean, I've literally seen the opposite of that at pro events where coaches have had towels or whatever to strap a player's elbow in.
Yeah.
The point that I had on the video today, you know, the magic trick, had a little fun with it. But when you pull your elbow in like that, you know, physiology is going to make the racket lay back. You know, so it's just the opposite. It doesn't shorten your swing. It makes it longer.
Chuck Creasy, who's one of the best character coaches in tennis, he's great to listen to. I know he's made a lot of efforts to try to improve American tennis. He used to tell kids to put a headband. You know, they got one in their bag and put the headband. And there was positive that teaching aid where, you know, so, okay, here's the pluses where it turns players to go this way.
Just turn, yeah.
But then the headband gets the elbows in too close.
Right.
With, I remember one of our players, she turned Harvard down. We've had quite a few players. That's the H-bomb Harvard. To say, yes, we've had some players turn Harvard down. So she goes on a recruiting trip, not to Harvard, but to another school, which she didn't go to. And when she went, you know, a couple of recruits were there and they're giving out, can't give out too many things, but they give out a t-shirt or whatever, but they had t-shirts against the elbow and people were practicing this way. And from a technical standpoint, we have to talk to the players we work with. When they go to work with other coaches, it's not to be a technical snob because they're going to hear things that are wrong because they know the math. But you know, there's so many different hats you have to wear as a coach. I think a character coach is so important, and you have to be able to teach character before you teach technique. I mean, you can explain things so well, but you got to be pretty convincing to get a kid to go forward.
Yeah.
I think with, to have a kid start the right way, you know, to be able to practice in a driveway, you know, you'll go on the side and toss balls to each other. you know, go out inside, just try to volley the ball up. You know, now kids don't play outside. My mother used to say this, where you drive through a wealthy neighborhood, and she said, they must be inside playing with a butler, playing bridge with a butler.
People today, if you go outside and play, if you're a kid, somebody will call Child Protective Services on you. Like, where's your mom? Where's your dad?
Yeah.
Oh, I just live two blocks over there, but
you're out. Yeah, no, alone. That's where... understood. That's scary. But that's where kids today, they are underprepared because they're overprotected. But rightfully so, they're overprotected. Yeah. That's where parents have to be clever and say, okay, in our backyard, if we could build a backboard. But you know, these rebound nets that we have. I know Ilya, one of our coaches, he's changed the backboard from great base to all in one, and on the back side.
Rebound net.
So all in one, you can practice all your shots. And on the side, he's got a string where you can pull it down for your toss. You can practice all your shots in your garage. But just one of those rebound nets, a ball back, there used to be a machine called, or teaching aid called, Stan Smith ball back. And it was at a 15-degree slope. So then the racket face could be vertical.
Yeah.
When you're volleying against the backboard, and the backboard's straight up and down,
yeah,
it's going to promote using a continental grip.
Exactly.
What I was going to say about the Division I players on the backhand side is, if you're watching 12 good tennis players, they got to the point where they're playing Division I tennis. Well, now I was going to say, you know, two or three, but all three players are coming in, all three foursomes are coming in. Mm-hmm. It's a very good chance there's not going to be one backhand volley. Where so like all you got to do is watch where the racket goes. If their left elbow's collapsed and their arm is bent, the racket face is open severely, racket face goes down.
Yeah.
And they don't go through it.
And it's not really where the impact's vertical, and then, you know, the impact pushes the racket down a little bit. It's more of like they're hacking at it, like you said.
I would say on the pro tennis circuit, the forehand volley straight across the board, it's usually the weakest shot of all, say, the pros.
The forehand volley?
Forehand volley, because they have a continental grip. They have their elbow in.
Well, see, I'm going to say I disagree with you on some aspect, just because a lot of those players have composite grips. They're towards an Eastern, a lot of them that I see, at least, where their composite grip.
No, well,
they're hitting their forehand volley flatter, and then the backhand volley is where they're going down a lot because of the open racket.
Yeah, that would apply to Nadal, for example. That would apply if it's closer to a forehand grip, where it's the angle of the racket face.
Yeah.
But the
players are trying to use a continental for sure.
But the drawbacks there's so many things to add to that, where if someone's playing a backhand, they're swinging from their shoulder out. If they're playing a forehand, the shoulder housing hits trailing.
Yeah.
You know, when you watch kids play doubles, young kids, all the time, every day, play backhand. Well, it's like Polly wants a cracker, play backhand. The ball comes right at them, and say, I'm right-handed. When you play against a right-hander, you want to hit at the right hip and say, you're sorry. You go right at them.
Yeah.
And so then they make this play.
Yeah.
Another thing that really hurts young kids' volume.
You're motioning a scooping, cupping action just for the...
Yeah, you're shortening the lever.
Yeah.
That's how you would hit it. That's how you'd hit a drop shot or a drop volley.
Yeah.
Instead of driving it. But when... kids are playing doubles as well. They're always looking to where the ball is going. Okay, my partner's here. I'm looking over here.
Right.
And then they got to shift. You're legally blind. Your vision's blurred.
Yeah.
If you look straight ahead and you just watch your opponent's rackets, if the racket's down, the ball's down. The racket's up, the ball's up.
Yeah.
But it's just like teaching a young kid to run. It's like they put blinders on a horse so the horse can run straight. You know, a kid's run, you just think about a relay race. And kids are acting. They're like, Mom, I'm working so hard. Look at me. And Mom's going, that's awesome. Let's go. You're super. And, but when you watch kids at a relay race in elementary school, you just have to shake your head. And it's like, whoa. Something that pertains to little kids and strategy. You watch little kids soccer, only two people know where to be.
Yeah.
The goalies. And
so true.
So you've got 22 people. 20 of them don't know where to go.
Yeah.
Where in tennis, we don't beat the kids up so much on strategy because it's one against one.
Yeah.
but you're running the wrong way. You're letting the ball bounce up. The ball's up here. And the farther you retreat from the baseline, the less chance you have of going to the net.
Yeah.
You know, if you, everything adds up. If you have a kid say, okay, you got to stay inside the baseline. You can't, if you leave the baseline, you lose the point. Mm-hmm. Then they're going to have a better chance. Most kids don't know that every time they come in have anxiety and they blow the approach shot, just dump it. Just one ball blast, and but they lose out on recognition skills. They can't read the ball, read the racket, make all the statistical cues to read the passing shot.
Yeah, learn to anticipate.
But to have the cool. But I would say, coming back to forehand volley, backhand volley, you know, it's not being pessimistic, doom or gloom, but they're weak on both sides. They're weak on both sides. And if they weren't, they would go, you'd see them going to the net.
Exactly. That's where, you know, yeah, you go watch your favorite player play and you see him volleying a certain way, you know, or let's say with a lot more down play, especially on the backhand side.
You know,
they're not going to the net.
When it comes down to coaching and changes, 1987, I went to Czechoslovakia, went to Prague to study tennis. And I was assigned a coach, and the coach had every national coach had six players. They were making more money on the black market when their players would return, give them a racket, and they would sell it. They weren't making much money. But it was interesting. Each coach had six players at different ages, different abilities, different genders, and they were assigned that player. This is your player. You were coaching these six players. I think of being at a tournament where Andy Brandy, and I'm 2 years younger than Andy, so when we were in our early 20s, he was with All American Sports maybe a year before I was. So I show up, I meet his older brother Joe, who coached Sampras when he won his first first Wimbledon title, or first Grand Slam, won the U.S. Open at age 19. That's Welby, 1939. Welby had the record until Sampras won that match. So, you know, there's no one who's the best. Oh, the best teacher, the best coach. Now I'm old enough, wise enough, is that I tire of the GOAT, greatest of all time. But Andy and I, early 20s, and I was saying Vic Braden is the best, and he was saying Welby Van Horn's the best. So I said, okay. I made the arrangements. Andy helped out where I went to work for Welby. So Jesse Levine, I think he's from Ottawa. He was with the USTA and went back to the Tennis Canada at one point. Played at Florida. Not the biggest guy, but an excellent tennis player. Mm. So I just sit down next to Andy and I said, Andy, Welby would not like your horse's volley backhand side. And, you know, he didn't have a strong grip. And then what Andy said was true. He goes, Steve, you got to know the variables where, you know, if you're a national coach, you know, like how long are you working with the player?
Yeah.
You know, it's like different coaches. And
sure.
You know, one bad coach is better than 10 different coaches.
Yeah.
And the way the brain works is if you just the same, and be taught a fundamental base.
Yeah.
And there's no secret sauce. I mean, it really comes right to it. People are looking for the secret sauce. People are selling the secret sauce.
Yep.
You know, like for myself, with a coaching tree, I had been in tennis for 5 years. And Andy and his brother Joe is like, whoa, this is different. These guys knew tennis. I could just tell from my background in ice hockey growing up. And that's a long time to go. You know, reading and watching. And then it's like, well, these guys, you know, they understand some methodology. Mm-hmm. And it came through Welby.
Yeah.
I think a Megan Broderick.
What were Welby's thoughts on the volley? Grips, swing path?
Well, you know, Welby would want to teach to serve last because he didn't want kids to be excited about playing. And the thing was that they'd be serving so poorly. You know, now you asked about the volley, but Welby would have a kid put the ball in the tray position, toss, tap, and have perfect balance.
Yeah,
so he's taught a low toss. He's taught rhythm.
Yeah.
So he would teach the serve, but he always wanted to wait. And it is more difficult to teach someone how to serve with a continental grip.
Yeah.
It's not the simplest thing to do. But yeah. With Welby was really big on teaching technique, slow with balance. You know, how he did it is you took a one-hour private lesson. The first several lessons, you know, we need to talk about Welby for a whole session.
Yeah.
But Welby, you wouldn't hit a ball for the first three lessons. Dennis Vandermeer's first wife, Linda, was taught by Welby. A lot of connections that way in tennis. Mm-hmm. I remember Dennis saying that Welby would be the worst resort coach in the world. With Welby, you weren't going to have the fun in the beginning.
Yeah.
He'd always, wherever he was, he went to the Choate School in Connecticut, and he was in his camps, and he was in Pinehurst, and he was in Boca. He'd want to have a 120-foot wall. So if you're taking a lesson from Welby, you'd hit the wall for 30 minutes, and then you take the lesson, and then you would shadow swing in front of his pro shop window. Mm-hmm. And if you weren't doing it the way he'd like, he'd hit balls at you. Mm-hmm. You know, Charlie Hollis, I know this through David Squire, who we mentioned, you had to skip. I think it was 1,000 skips a day. And if you didn't do it every day, you couldn't have your lesson.
Yeah.
Then when you go take your lesson from Charlie Hollis, you had to be there before, and you had to do your skips before the lesson started. Mm-hmm. Let me say this about our boy Squire. You know, he went through our training. And His son, his son plays quite well now. But Squire in Aussie, yeah, Henry Squire, you know, goes, well, no, I just don't buy it. You volley with a continental grip. And I go, well, Squire, you dummy, let me convince you. The composite grip used to be called the Australian grip. So now you can teach this Australian grip.
Oh, all right, mate. Oh, okay.
But Megan Broderick, I remember, and she could run like the wind. She's from a family of runners, and we have all sorts of film. She's on our course, Tennis Intelligence Applied. So the Federation calls me up and says, this is the oxymoron. She volleys so well, but we have to change her grips. She doesn't volley continental.
Yeah, exactly.
It is like, okay. So, we've worked with so many players that have become, and we worked with her from the time she was nine. Mike Larshai from Wisconsin,
yeah,
sent her to us. They moved to Tampa, and through juniors, but we have coached so many kids that have been one through five, right up there in the top in their age groups, and then they have to be taught advanced techniques. There's not many advanced techniques. I would say an advanced technique would be taking a beginner from grip on three to in between two and three. That would be one. Another would be like a pinpoint on the serve or a karaoke step on the backhand. Then you have to teach, there's basic shots, special shots, emergency shots.
Right.
Just like with Chet Murphy, there's going to be times that ball's over here and you're going to snap the racket, however you want to label it.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to teach basic shots before you teach specialty shots, before you teach emergency shots.
Yeah.
Dave Secker, I was with him, and he was at the girls' 18s. There's a player there that we had coached. I know you worked with her in Germany. We did a camp in Germany at Squire's place. Sophia Patel.
Oh, yeah.
And, she spent most of her time, she was taught by Matt Clore, but I had spent a ton of time working with her, and Secker said to her, and I'll never forget this, he goes, you can play all over the court. You've got great volleys. You can hit an overhead. And he said to her, don't you think it's fun to hit volleys? Mm-hmm. Don't you think it's fun to hit volleys and overheads?
Yeah.
I mean, you got to get to the point where you love to take the ball in the air.
Mm-hmm.
And you're looking for that. You hit, you recover to that baseline, and you're just looking to take the ball in the air.
Yeah. I think that's where it goes back again. I mean, well, we will talk about brain typing. There are some reasons why someone may not go forward just from their inborn type personality, but just understanding the court and understanding the stats.
With Carlos Goffi is his son coaches in South Carolina now. He wrote the book Tournament Tough.
Yeah.
Great personality. He did a lot of work with the McEnroes when he was younger. In his book Tournament Tough, Bill Jacobson, that's where he got the idea of a green light point,
yeah,
a yellow light point, red light point. A green light point is not just when you're up.
Right.
But it's when you're down. If you're down love 40, well, my chances of winning this game.
Yeah.
Or even in a tiebreaker, you know, people say, do you have any strategy for the beginning of a tiebreaker? Anytime the score is shortened, that's where, okay, there's more of a chance for an upset. You know, if it's a no-ad set versus, you know, if it's a two sets and play a 10-point tiebreaker versus, right, okay, it's going to be a five-set ordeal on the men's side.
Yeah.
But when it comes down to the beginning of a tiebreaker, you know, if a kid's never going to the net, all of a sudden you go in a couple times, it throws the other person off.
Exactly, yeah.
You don't want to mix it up to the point where you're mixed up. But yeah.
Green light point.
Yeah.
40-15, 40-love, 30-love. Take the chance, go in.
Coming back to, you know, the two-handed backhand volley, Connors all the way through.
Yep.
Two-handed drove it.
Yeah.
I think of Frew McMillan, you know, he hit two-handed volleys on both sides. The ball doesn't know. The ball just knows how's that racket faced at the impact point.
Exactly.
We've mentioned it, you know, Denis Shapovalov and Miron Mann. We talked about tennis in Canada, previous podcast. Jimmy Arias recently said, and this is one thing I like about Denis's game, he gets any sniff of offense, he's taking it. He's taking it. You got to be aggressive. Mm-hmm. And Jimmy Arias said, I love how he goes to the net, but he doesn't really know what he's going to do when he gets up there.
Exactly.
And there is a guy who I can remember, you know, that was one thing that with Richard, that people are really hung up on that no, you have to volley the continental grip. And Richard didn't win that battle with Tessa.
Yeah.
On our course, Tennis Intelligence Applies, 25-hour course, when you get to the point where there's a clip and say, well, we don't teach the continental grip on the forehand volley. And I say on the little clip, and some of you will stop the course right here.
Yeah.
And there's a gentleman who runs his own tennis school in North Carolina, and he told me that's exactly what he did. He got to that point, he goes, this is wrong. But then what happened is he saw our students play.
Yeah.
Saw our students play.
It reminds me of, we were talking about Max earlier too, but when Max and Jamie Serratani were here last year, for preseason as well, Roosh Ganji, who's, you know, decent junior player, he was here, and Jamie was just going, that kid can volley. But you were going, it's too bad he doesn't come to the net.
Yeah, it doesn't have the internal wire, and the drill is forcing him to go to the net.
Yeah.
I
think, you know, with a continental grip, first of all, you know, I'm sure obviously people are taught the continental grip, but on the pro tour, I spent a lot of time on the Challenger Tour, especially, but they really don't have continental grips. They have composite grips on the forehand towards an eastern, and then on the backhand side, they may shift the heel pad a little bit, but the racket face is more open, and so they're cutting down a lot more on the backhand side, and they're pretty flat on the forehand side.
I was in Slovenia, I know you worked with Blaž Rola. He played at Ohio State when my son was there, and so I'm in his home country. This is where he played. These are the indoor courts, and the indoor courts, really fast, worn out carpet. And, but I remember he played college tennis, one up, one back.
Yeah.
They won three. With I say they, Chase Buchanan.
Chase, yeah.
Had a little bit of a flaw in his serve, but they won three out of the three. National doubles. And but does that take them, so that's college tennis, you know, where did that take them as far as pro tennis?
Yeah.
With but I do think that, you know, I understand where college coaches are. Okay, my job is to win for such and such, whatever university signs my check. Mm-hmm. I think coaches, parents, I mentioned it briefly, that many times a college coach, they're going to plug you in like, okay, you're a number six, you're a number five. And it's not, they're so busy with academics and now they're in their 20s and they're trying to find themselves and, you know, they're not living at home anymore. In junior tennis, you're trying to make everybody a number one. Yeah. Yeah, but you mentioned Arush. I mean, you know, he's been home studying for the SATs. Mm-hmm. And
coming back soon.
Yeah, so, but I will, I mean, I told a young lefty, Malhar Patel today, you know, he plays a dumb shot. And I go, yeah, you probably get about 950 on your SAT. And when it's like, come on, just what's the right answer? The right answer is, you know, there's physics, there's geometry. There's hard sciences that you want to really be governed by. The soft science comes into it. And I understand that's where coaches, it's a human relationship and there's artistry involved. But with kids, they've got the bag, they're going here, they're going there, and they, you know, they're not going to, they're going to play 100 points, hit five volleys.
Yeah.
And
no, I think when it really does, to sum up with the volley, some of the main points, you know, we talked a lot about the grip, the continental grip. You know, you can be successful with a continental grip. It's just going to take more calculation. So, I mean, you know, like you use the term doom and gloom. It's not, you don't have to be so doom and gloom on the continental grip, but it's just going to take more wrist adjustment, especially on the forehand side, on high balls. You got to play the volley later.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the downplay with the open racket face. So it just takes more calculation if that's the system you want to choose to do, or you want to try to put more spin on your volley. Great. I mean, Vic would say, oh, okay. You know, yeah, no, you don't have to do it like you were talking about earlier, but really the proof's in the pudding. It's like, are you going to the net? Are you successful when you're going to the net? So that's really what it comes down to. And hopefully
I do think, you know, Central to Northern Europe, coming back to that, kids will do play. We Americans think they just play on clay, but they can play like Rolla, slow in the summer and fast in the winter.
Sure. Yeah.
Here in the US it's too much the same.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a hard court, you know, so players don't have they don't have the defense that they would learn through red clay.
Yeah.
And they have to realize that a hard court is a medium court. It's not like, say, a carpet or, you know, bad grass.
Yeah.
I think Jack Kramer, he was the number one junior in the United States. And his father said, you know, now you're going to play men's tennis. You know, and I'd say the biggest difference between, say, you know, boys tennis, men's tennis, girls tennis, women's tennis, is can you play all over the court? Can you play aggressively?
Yeah.
It's not a matter of waiting for the other person to miss. You have to get to the point where you force them to miss.
Yeah.
And, you know, then when people go to the net, they don't understand really most of the time that first volley is a setup volley, then they got to close in.
Yeah.
Now you know, I think of, you know, baseliners will set up a point to play one volley. They're just, you know, they're going to work the point.
Yeah.
But you don't want to just be one dimensional. You want to get to the point where you can, you know, have some variety.
Yeah. Serve and volley, come in when somebody's in a weak position, hit an approach shot.
Yeah.
Be great.
You know, when it comes down to the last thing for me is, we'll mention it quite often, but Dennis Vandam wrote a great phrase, the interrelationship of strokes, interrelationship of spins.
Yeah.
You know, you get in the ready position, turn with the racket head up high. You know, one of our own phrases, you know, we do have some originality, the path of the racket to the path of the target.
Yeah.
Obviously people talk so much about racket path, but just to repeat that, path of the racket, path of the target, connect the dots.
Yeah, exactly.
Strings don't lie. And, you know, we tell people, okay, put the racket in your hand, now put your hand on your head, put your hand on the back of your head, put your hand on your ear, wherever your hand goes. I think soft hands, you know, most kids hang onto the racket way too tight.
Yeah.
You know, when a kid misses, even if they're wrong, they need to, you know, correct that process. But, you know, just to wrap it up, I mean, why would a kid miss long? Okay, the continental, strong grip will open the racket face, a weak grip.
Yeah.
They lift their head because the brain's ahead of the hip by a fifth of a second.
That disrupts the path.
They bring the hand back in because they're nervous. Freud's return to the womb concept. the Aussies used to call it the elbow. They get the elbow and leaning back. But also, I'd say a lot of players miss long because they've been told, Hick used to have a film of Brian Gottfried, and he, what a great player. And Gottfried would say, well, at first I drive the ball, and then I turn underneath to keep the ball in the court.
Yeah.
And so the film is he drives the ball, and by the time you feel the hit, the ball's 7 to 11 feet away from you.
Right.
So the ball is like, you know, 10 feet away, and he goes, and now I'm doing this to control the ball.
Yeah. We say 3 to 5, 3 to 6 millisecond event. Takes about 50 to 70 milliseconds for that sensation to reach the brain. So by the time you feel it, the ball's long gone.
You know, we do these exercises where beginners, it's great. Everybody can do it. Go up against a wall, put the edge of the racket right against the wall, turn, and just push your racket into the wall.
Yeah.
You know, we do, you know, trace the shape of the swing on your forehand. So when you turn, you put your edge on the wall like this, and you push forward.
Yeah.
Racket stays right on the wall,
yeah,
or the fence. Now you just turn, and now you just go around this way. And that's where the great players who can steal the ace. You know, it's like the return's more like a volley with an added follow through.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so
I can stay close to the baseline.
But then what you want to do is establish your territory first. So I'm going to stay in here close, and I'll just, not to use the word block,
yeah,
but it's a sensation. As soon as you're teaching, okay, just block the ball. But then you don't swing slow. You counter speed with speed. So then you've established your territory. And then, okay, now I'm going to turn to here, and all I got to do is go underneath.
Yeah.
And if you look at you just go like, say, Djokovic today, Agassi, Connors. That's why they had great returns.
Yeah. We've covered a lot. I feel like there's so much more we could talk about, but yeah, just be basic first, you know, get basic technique down, especially if, you know, when the young kid's building up, and then obviously you're going to be able to adapt and improvise all the things you have to do as an elite tennis player.
Yeah, you have to be able to show it. You know, we tell kids, we start working with, we say, okay, at this point, we don't care what you think. What do you know? Show us, tell us what you know. Show us what you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I was training coaches in this academic setting, you had one of two types, you know, especially the boys, you know, macho male ego. They actually thought they knew how to teach tennis. And when we would start our program, the U.S. Open was going on. I used to say, well, if you're any good, you'd be at the U.S. Open. You're here. But we used to do this where, you know, the students created the rules, and the rules form the culture. Mm. You go into a small room like this, and you pick one out of seven things out of a hat. And say you get the forehand volley. Mm. And you stand up on a table.
Yeah.
It's just you and one student assistant, and they push the camera. And now you have to explain the forehand volley.
Yeah.
And it wasn't even ready position, turn. It was bad. It was just punch the volley. It's just a punch. That's all you got. And, you know, we used to do this where students would wear a backpack and they would tape themselves. You know, Braden told us to do this. And then they'd have to write a manuscript. They'd have to type out everything they said in the lesson.
Yeah.
And
so they had a cassette recorder back then.
Yeah. And punch the volley, punch the volley. So pretty soon, the person on the other side, they're punch drunk from hearing punch the volley. You know, another thing too is you hear don't swing, don't swing.
Yeah.
You take the racket through space with body rotation. So what the pros can do, the pros can turn more. And they've been playing forever. So, you know, with the young players though, here's another mistake. There's so many things we go on and on for volleys is that they get lazy and they just set their hand.
Yeah.
Just set your hand. So they set their hand. Now they turn their body and their swing's too big.
Too big.
So it has to be a unit turn. But in other sports, the basketball player gets on the foul line. You know, the baseball player gets in the on deck circle and they repeat the movement.
Yeah.
And it's not that sophisticated. But, you know, you could say this is simplification is sophistication.
Yeah.
So the simpler, the better.
Yeah.
But you need to be able to explain what you're doing. If someone, and I read this recently, that every kid should be taught in this country, the American football, every athlete should be taught like they're the quarterback. You go to huddle with yourself, you can call the play, and, you know, quarterbacks are really students of the game.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
I tell kids all the time, I say, well, you're playing basketball, the coach is going to pick you to be the guard bringing the ball down the court, because, you know, lights on, but nobody's home. The elevator doesn't reach the top floor. And But again, today, not too many kids, you know, that's just not politically correct. Let's be nice. You don't have to go to the net. Forget the volley. You don't have to volley. You can do whatever you want.
It's too bad because, you know, like David Secker, don't you like to go to the net? Isn't it fun? It is fun. You know, it's fun. Try it. Serve and volley. Try to hit an approach shot. Go in. Have some fun.
Well, when it comes down to in academia, you don't have a choice. Okay, first we're going to count. Now we're going to do arithmetic. We're going to add. Mm-hmm. Then we're going to subtract. And there's building blocks.
Yeah.
And that's another thing, too, is the volley, say the forehand volley, the backhand volley. Well, there's a low forehand volley. There's a swinging volley. But just say the basic forehand volley.
Right.
I mean, it's like singing Happy Birthday. It's like singing Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. Mm-hmm. Now, you're singing, you're playing on an instrument. Well, you can get better and better at playing that song. You can get better and better with your voice.
Yeah.
But it's still the same song.
Yeah.
In the volley, it's like, isn't there a little bit more to this? Yeah. Braden used to say that. This is an expensive course. Is that all it is? Just turn and push.
Yeah. Be brilliant with basics.
On the backhand volley, I think it's important to just, you know, someone could sit in a chair, and if they were to practice for five, Braden used to say this, they practice for 5 minutes for 5 days. Put your cell phone down. Your parents could be driving you back from the lesson and you got a racket and you're just doing the three things to go to a backhand volley. Mm-hmm. You're going to turn, change your grip and straighten your arm.
Yeah.
Turn, change your grip, straighten your arm. You do all three simultaneously. Another point is that when you're volleying, if you're a little kid and you volley two-handed, when you're up at the net, two hands are here.
Yeah.
Now, we teach kids to hit a two-handed backhand volley when they're really young, but from day one, from the get-go, wouldn't want any of our listeners to go, they always teach a two-handed backhand volley. You really need to show up and watch what we do. Is that, no, you want to teach that one-handed backhand volley from the get-go.
Yeah.
The ball doesn't know it's being hit by a two-hander, one-hander. And, you know, the difference is when you hit one-handed, you're going to stay sideways. When you hit two-handed, your hips turn in.
Yeah, a little further out in front on the one-hander.
But don't say this if you go to the park and you want to hit balls with someone. Don't go, you want to volley some. Because if you want to volley some, that means you both stay at the net and just hit balls up in the air.
Yes, sir. All right, everybody. Well, we appreciate you listening if you are still with us. And?
Yeah, so we'll cover other basic shots. We can keep going. We'll talk next week, tune in.
We'll go through one of our pillars next week.
Yeah, that's one of eight people. But we have this course, Tennis Intelligence Applied. We credit eight educators, contributors. But during that course, we mentioned over 100 coaches. So.
Yeah.
Learn from everybody.
Yeah, I think for what we covered tonight on the volley, if you want to go check out some of our courses on greatbasetennis.com or even our YouTube channel, youtube.com/greatbasetennis, you can go to Tennis Intelligence Applied and look up the volley in the classroom and then on the court. And then on the other courses, Great Base Initiative, go through the checkpoints on the volley as well. So check that out.
Yeah, there's not much of a plot, a little boring, but if you want to improve your tennis game.
Which you do, listeners, right? Game of a lifetime. Check us out on social media at Great Base Tennis. We're everywhere, sort of. And yeah.
All right, thanks for listening. Adios, amigos.
I'm Andy Fitzell.
I'm Steve Smith. Over and out.
Steve Smith, over and out.
I'm the good-looking one.
Seriously, got a birthday coming up.
Yeah, 39.
All right, everybody, we will see you in the next one. Thanks again.